when you know, outfits.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to talk with Aaron Gill, Western Pennsylvania organizer for Pennsylvania Health Access Network. Also in the second hour, we're going to talk with Allison Hirsch, former college professor turned community organizer. I'm going to talk to her about health care and, Medicare in particularly, along with Social Security. Being a senior citizen, being retired. What does all this talk mean? What is all this? It's a Ponzi scheme. Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. It's a monstrous lie. What does all this talk mean to someone who's retired? So it'll be interesting to have a conversation with her. Also, your phone calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. So how'd everybody do this weekend? What a weekend it was. The weather in the neighborhood, not very good. My wife and I were wondering if it would ever stop. The thunder and lightning all weekend long with the showers. Fortunately, we didn't have any water in our basement, but I know a lot of folks did. And I know by our house, the river was higher than I think I've ever seen it. And we've lived there, a little over six years now, and it's the highest I have ever seen it. This was a pretty major storm. And I'm glad to see everyone kind of digging out. Sadly, we lost a number of folks. And it's tragic. It's absolutely tragic. But part of me says, when you don't heed the warnings, and there were plenty of warnings in all of this, that we should have stayed out, should have stayed home and not out, in the mess. Sometimes you have to wonder. So, I'm glad the storm is over. We'll start digging out. We were home on Friday. There was a curfew in the neighborhood, here in Harrisburg. Of which I had to go home and avoid. Fortunately, I got home. But, you looked around, and the Susquehanna was higher than I had ever seen it. It really dangerous, dangerous stuff. So the devastation is there. And what I found interesting, now, I'm not blaming the governor. The governor is going to do what any governor would do when his state is hit by something like this. He had said the other day that he had hoped that the president would sign a disaster declaration, covering about 44 counties here in the state of Pennsylvania, so that homeowners could get some money from the federal government, to cover, the essential home stuff, the stuff that were damaged, furniture, furnaces, stoves, stuff like that. Here's my problem with this. The more I hear people like Corbett and Christie and really the right-wing wrecking crew, that we need states' rights, we don't need the federal government in our way, we need to make them small and ineffective, we need to starve them, we need to take all the resource from them. And then something like this happens, and there's no money. And you get somebody like Cantor, and the rest of the right-wing wrecking crew who say, well, we need to have cuts from somewhere else. We need to make someone else miserable to help these miserable people. Because, look, I mean, if your house and all your possessions were washed away in this storm, you're not jumping for joy. And understand that a lot of folks don't have flood insurance. A lot of people's homeowners insurance aren't going to cover it. And, you know, some people just don't have it. A lot of people are renters. A number of the folks that, you know, I had seen on the news were people who lived in trailers. Their trailer floated away. All of their possessions floated away. So how do you help those folks? The governor, and to his credit, I got to give him credit. He did what I think any governor would do, which is go to the federal government. But here's the thing. When you have run a political career on, I don't want anything to do with the federal government, that everything should be left to the states, I find it a bit hypocritical. And that's my only real knock on him. I think everything else went well. You saw your tax dollars at work as police and rescue crews were out. Here in Harrisburg, you really saw your tax dollars at work as they had blocked off streets and they had people making sure that you didn't have gawkers going down to the river and going, look, Marge, I can step in the water, and then being halfway down the river by the time they realize it. Fortunately, I don't think there were any of those incidents, but that's because the police were standing there, and good for them. But those are your tax dollars at work. Also this weekend, the 9/11-a-thon, I gotta be honest, I'm now officially 9/11'd out. I feel the pain. I'm hoping that the families are healing. I think you need to remember, you need to have your memorial, you need to help folks who are in pain and who are suffering. And, you know, kind of remember, and I spent the weekend, you know, talking with my wife, remembering where I was, because we were talking about where we were on 9/11. And, you know, I was in Cleveland, my grandmother was having knee surgery, she was having a knee replaced, and in the hours, because she went under an anesthetic at 8 a.m., in the hours that she was under the knife, the world changed. So when she went under, the world was a completely different place than when she woke up. And in that time when I was in Cleveland, you know, I saw some very disturbing things. And I was there watching these doctors who were from Middle Eastern descent, high-fiving each other and asking each other, did you do that? And kind of in a joking way. And fortunately, a number of them were fired days later, as they should have been. But I also remember going home that night, and I had driven from Pennsylvania to Cleveland, and as I'm known to do, I was on fumes. So when I left the hospital that night, the first gas station I passed was $8 a gallon. The second gas station was $8.20 a gallon. And by the time I decided I better stop, because by the time I get home, it'll probably be $20 a gallon. And for 3 gallons of gas, I paid $8.50 a gallon that evening. Now, the next day, of course, the mayor of Cleveland, he had a coming to Jesus moment, if you will, and told all the gas stations who gouged people that they better start paying back or he was going to take their license. But, you know, that's the kind of hysteria that happened that day. And what I remember that day saying, this is going to be the game changer. This is going to give Bush everything he wanted. And what it really has brought us, and, you know, I haven't really heard many people talking about it. It brought us to a state of perpetual war. We are now fully living 1984. We are fully living the book, because we're constantly at war with someone. And that's just part of normal life. We've gotten over it. Like, it doesn't, you know, that's going on. No big deal. And we're now accustomed to it. Another part of what the post 9/11 world has brought us is the death of habeas corpus, the death of posse comitatus, things that we used to take for granted. The fact that if my government takes me into custody, I have a right to know why. Not anymore. And I also had some security knowing that my government couldn't turn its military on me. Both of those are gone. in this post 9/11 world, what we've been brought is things like torture and waterboarding. Now part of the mainstream. It's part of who we are. We actually debate when we can torture somebody. What does that say about us? What does it say about what happened on that day? Also brought us government invasion. The fact that under the Patriot Act, which was rammed through without very much debate, and in fact the vast majority of people never read it. I go back to the day I went to the League of Women Voters, had a they had a debate. Three people for it, three people against it. Oddly enough, the three people for it read the executive summary. The three people against it actually sat and read every single page and were able to tell you exactly everything wrong with it. And at the end of the night, the people who were in the audience were for the people who were for it, because it played to the worst of us. It played to our fears. So this weekend, I kept seeing all of these ads. Everybody, every guy, I think Verizon had one, Budweiser, everybody had an ad. You know, we need to celebrate our heroes. We need to celebrate the fact that these heroes ran into these buildings. We need to celebrate the fact that these people were the heroes of the day. Every time I turned around watching football. In fact, the NFL was one big, happy, not sure how to put it. It was one big sloppy wet kiss to the nostalgia folks. And my question, as I kept seeing these ads pop up over and over and over and over again, where were these ads pushing to take care of those heroes? Where were those ads pushing to take care of those families? Where were they? Oh, there were no profits in that. There was no advertising in that. There was no, hey, look at me, I'm a patriotic American corporation in that. None whatsoever. And you look at the costs of 9/11. What did it cost us? Osama bin Laden had two primary goals, they said. Two. Really three. One being breaking our relationship with Israel, because he said that we had this relationship where Israel could do no wrong in our eyes. I'm not so sure about that, but the other two were very doable in his eyes. One, he wanted oil prices at $200. So $200 a barrel. At the time, I think they were like $12 or $15 a barrel. Now we're looking at $100 a barrel oil. And two was to break this country. Break us by bleeding us to the point of bankruptcy. So we're now in perpetual war in the Middle East and South Asia. So we're now in this. And we've been here for 10 years in Afghanistan, 9 in Iraq. Remember Operation Iraqi Liberation? I mean Freedom. When they figured out the oil thing, they changed it. Operation Iraqi Freedom. We've lost some 6,400 American soldiers, men and women. We've seen tens of thousands more injured and maimed. And we've seen about $1.2 trillion of our treasury evaporate. Some say it's up to $3 trillion just in Iraq alone. And that doesn't even take into account what we've done to those countries, the tens of thousands that we've killed, if not hundreds of thousands, and the millions more who are refugees running away from danger. That doesn't take that into account. And you look at that resource, those 6,400 lives, all of those tens of thousands of men and women who were maimed and injured. What opportunity cost did that come at? What have we lost? And you stop and you think about all of the treasury that we have just, without debate, without budget, most of it was done on the credit card. Oh, yeah, special emergency appropriations bills. You and I didn't have say in that. They just did it. Was it worth it? Was going into Iraq worth it? We didn't get the oil. Was going into Afghanistan worth it? So you stop and you look at all the opportunity costs, the health care, the education, the military veterans programs we could have had, teachers, policemen, everything, you name it. We could have changed our energy policy in this country by doing things that now we're told we just don't have the money for. I'm sorry, those teachers, they're just government employees we can do without. Sorry, those policemen, well, we could cut that out. Sorry, those post office, we're going to have to close those. because we just don't have the money. We're broke. And sorry, those people who saw their homes float away, sorry. We just don't have the money. We're broke. So the question then becomes, was it worth it? And when I look back to 9/11, I, having never been a huge Bill Clinton fan, and having never thought that I would actually miss him, on that day, I missed Bill Clinton because of what he did in 93 and what he did when they bombed, when they tried to blow up the Trade Center the first time, and what they did after they blew up the Mirror Building. They treated them as criminals, not as a crusade, not as a religious movement. My God wasn't bigger than your God, but as criminals to be taken into custody and dealt with. And we could have done that. And we chose the wrong path. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this.
Yes, it is all about the children. Even after they're born. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. As President Obama pressures Congress to actually take action to create jobs, there's evidence that government spending to create jobs works. Doug Cunningham files this report.
When Obama became president, it was like becoming captain of the Titanic just after it hit the iceberg. The Bush Great Recession, the economic meltdown created by Wall Street, was causing massive jobs hemorrhage. Between December of 08 and April of 09, 3.8 million jobs were lost. 8.8 million jobs were lost by the time the recession officially ended. Now Obama is calling Congress to task to pass his American Jobs Act to create more badly needed jobs while giving tax breaks to working families and businesses and extending unemployment benefits for the millions still out of work. The kind of government action on jobs that Obama is calling for works. His 2009 $787 billion stimulus package created millions of jobs. The Congressional Budget Office says at least 1.4 million jobs were created directly by the stimulus, while as many as 3.6 million were created while stimulus money was being spent. Moody's Analytics estimates the stimulus created 2.7 million jobs. So government stimulus works. It's just that so far it hasn't been big enough to create the jobs that are needed to fully recover from the Great Recession.
One piece of President Barack Obama's jobs bill that in a less polarized Congress would easily pass is his call for an infrastructure bank. The concept has been discussed before, most recently by Senators John Kerry, a Democrat, and Kay Bailey Hutchinson, a Republican. Obama's proposal is closely based on the one the two senators introduced in March of this year. It calls for $10 billion in seed money to help get it off the ground. The president's job proposal includes $50 billion in infrastructure upgrades that the bank could oversee. The bank has the support of a wide group of unlikely allies. In March, the AFL-CIO and Chamber of Commerce stood side by side and endorsed the idea. The day after Obama's speech, a number of Wall Street bigwigs, including J.P. Morgan, also said it was a necessity. Those endorsements may not be enough for the Tea Party caucus in the House of Representatives. Minutes after the president gave his speech, House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee Chair John Mica of Florida came out swinging. He told reporters that he's strongly opposed to any type of a new federal infrastructure bank.
Workers' rights under attack. What do we do?
Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy, The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you could download the podcast there. Or if you got one of these smartphones, download the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go with you. Well, you know, in the post 9/11 world, I guess there's no more Mile High Club either. I don't know if you saw this over the week on Sunday. There were two airplanes, one going from Los Angeles to New York to the JFK airport, and the other going from Denver to Detroit. Both because they were people on the planes. Suspicious behavior. That's the language that they used because, you know, people were acting a little funny. The first situation was resolved before the plane landed, because the passenger then complied with the directions of the federal marshal. Everything was hunky-dory. The second one, a little bit trickier. They actually had to take the plane to a remote area, quarantine it off, search it for explosives. Because there was suspicious behavior. And they did it. Why? Abundance of caution. Something else we're going to have to get used to, the abundance of caution. Turns out, as they said, out of the abundance of caution, NORAD scrambled F-16 jets. And why were they scrambled? It turns out... The couple, do whatever you want to, however you want to put this in your mind, they were making out, they were trying to be part of the Mile High Club, whatever it is that you want to imagine in your head, they were in the middle of some intimate moment, if you will, they were having intimate relations, another way of putting it, because they were in the bathroom too long, they're scrambling jets because someone's in the bathroom too long. We really are living in a very, very bizarre time. And even more so when you look at this Oklahoma State legislator, this Sally Kernan. We've talked about her before. She's pretty much off the deep end, one of these homophobes who, you know, basically now saying that homosexuality is worse than terrorism. See, we can put up with those towel heads. We can put up with those people strapping bombs to their backs. It's just those people who like people like them. No, can't do that. Sorry. Not going to happen. Doesn't that scare you? I mean, do we not have more pressing problems? Do we not have more troubles than worrying about what people do in the privacy of their own home? Like the death of the middle class. Personally, I think that's a pretty important thing. I would prefer to have a thriving middle class than to be free of gay people. It just seems logical to me. What about you? 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. And the reason I bring up the death of the middle class is the newspaper of the investor class, the Wall Street Journal, had a front page story, as middle class shrinks, P&G aims high and low. Corporate America has already figured out what I've been telling you for years. There are two classes, and what, you know, John Edwards ran on when he ran for president. There are two Americas. There are the very, very wealthy, and then there's everybody else. And everybody else is getting broker and broker by the day. And all of those guys that I used to work with who, we don't need that welfare program. We don't need them there food stamps. We don't need health care for them poor kids. Those programs that they were bad-mouthing all of those years, I have several friends who those programs have saved them from depression. Now you look at the safety net that we had, and a very tattered one at that, saved us from a depression. But corporate America has figured out, and they're very honest about it, corporate America has figured out that there is no more middle class. They write, for generations, Procter & Gamble's growth strategy was focused on developing household staples for the vast American middle class, because there was this big middle class with disposable income at Procter & Gamble. You know, they wanted to sell their toothpaste and their laundry detergent. And, you know, the article points out that 98% of the households in this country have something made by Procter & Gamble, which is amazing to me. But here you go. He says now P&G executives say many of its former middle market shoppers are trading down to lower priced goods. Widening the pool of have and have not consumers at the expense of the middle. And they're going, look, here's the reality. We know that those middle class people don't have any income now. They're now shopping at dollar stores instead of Walmart and Target. And again, you know, nice job, Walmart. You're screwing yourself with this race to the bottom. Congratulations. Kudos to you. Because now people are so broke, they're going to dollar stores. And now you've got companies like Procter & Gamble going, well, we can't. Nobody's going to buy that middle-income soap, or nobody's going to buy that middle-income laundry detergent, or no one's going to buy that toothpaste. So now we've got to start making the generic stuff for the poor people, all of you, and, you know, have our higher line for the very, very wealthy, because there's still some of them. And what I find interesting is in the article they point out that in this country, we, at the end of March, American households had about $6.1 trillion of equity in their houses. That's, you know, the value of your house minus whatever mortgage payment you have. They're saying that in 2006, and this goes to exactly what I've been saying about the massive theft that has gone on in this country from the middle class. In 2006, that $6.1 trillion was more than double that. So we have seen the working class of this country has seen the value of their main asset, their home, plummet in value. And in most cases, at least a quarter, people are upside down and they actually owe more. And what I found interesting, according to the Federal Reserve, this is what they've pointed out, the economist Edward Wolf, he's a professor at New York University. The fact of the matter is that the household, the middle fifth, that's the middle class, that middle fifth of American households grew by 2.4% between 2001 and 2006, and then plunged 26.2%. So you had a very small growth, and then just basically off the cliff. And PP&G and a whole bunch, they list a whole litany of companies, all of them, these consumer product companies saying, you know what? There's no more middle ground. All there is rich and poor. And I don't know about you, but when I go to the store, you know, now it's what I got in my pocket. Because we don't use the credit card that often for grocery purchases. And, you know, now people are saying, you know, we got two Americas here.
No, when I go to the store, to be honest, Rick, I never was like this. I was never one for coupons or whatever. But when I go, and if I see there's a special, I take it. And I, you know, a couple years ago when I retired, I thought I'd be on easy street. Well, guess not. For the second time, I got hit by, I put my money in the market. Second time I got hit. So 4 years ago, I thought I was in good shape. Not so much anymore.
And what they point out in the article is that the one woman, the Citigroup analyst, points out that the consumer hourglass is even more pronounced now than it has ever been. And that's, you know, rich people at the top have a whole bunch of money and then a whole bunch of poor people at the bottom. Very little in that middle. As where we had a diamond-shaped economy at one point, where you had a nice, big, healthy middle class. And you had poor people and you had some rich people, but the vast majority of people were somewhere in that middle ground. They were able to consume these products. And again, you know, I go back to this, and it's corporate America telling you, folks, there's a problem in the country. There is a massive, massive problem with the distribution of wealth here. And they go into this, their marketing strategy. Their twos, you know, you have one, two, three, four, and five. Your ones are those are your main shoppers. You're going to do all right with them. Your twos are your poorer, your former working class folks, the people who are struggling to get by, but they're still buying your product. They're aiming their whole marketing campaign at those people who used to be middle class. Now, the threes, the people at the bottom, they could care less about them. And they even admit that in the article. They say, look, you know, they're always going to be poor, so never mind them. But I find it quite interesting that the newspaper of the investor class is telling us that it's over. Games are over. The final quote that I loved, this has been the most humbling experience of our job, this analyst says. The numbers of middle America have been shrinking because people have been getting hurt so badly economically that they've fallen into lower incomes. So I go back to this. How do you then distribute the wealth in a way where you create that middle class? Because, look, now they're going to start cutting jobs at Procter & Gamble. which means even more middle-income jobs going by the wayside. We are following this Walmart path, which is the race to the bottom. How cheap can we get workers, and how cheap can we get products, and how cheap, and all the way down to the bottom. Now, that might be all fine, well, and good, but the reality is this country that used to have a ladder into the middle class, well, they've put that on roller skates, and good luck doing it. But they're very honest about it, and you have to give them credit. Extremely honest about the fact that the middle class is disappearing, evaporating before our very eyes. And why is that? You know, tonight the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs had their little debate. And again, it's all about how can we screw workers? Again, how can we screw the working class? And look, if you don't think this is a, you know, I have people tell me all the time, Rick, you talk about class too much. You know, we're a classless society. Didn't you know that? Maybe we soon will be a classless society when there are only two classes, the very, very wealthy and then everybody else. And you're part of the everybody else, because I don't know anybody listening to this program who is in the investor class. You know, if you're worth a couple $100 million, I don't think you're wasting your time. I think you're out there figuring out how you can screw those working people and take more of their assets. But again, this is scary, scary stuff. But at least they're honest. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
As governor of Texas, Rick Perry has been a 5-watt bulb sitting in a 100-watt socket. When the hot and dry tinderbox of Central Texas recently exploded into 4 raging wildfires that killed 2 people and burned 1,000 family homes down to their slabs, Perry wasn't even in his socket. He was in South Carolina campaigning for president. So he had to rush back a day late to pose as governor. He did a mess of photo ops and even took a political potshot at Barack Obama, blaming him for shortchanging Texas on federal firefighting help. But wait. Perry wasn't just a day late. He's been months late in providing the most basic state leadership to deal with such disasters. Texas has been ablaze with hundreds of wildfires since late last year, torching millions of acres all across the state. Yet, scrambling recklessly this spring to fill a gaping deficit he had created in the state budget, guess whose funding Perry whacked by 75%? Volunteer firefighters! Volunteer departments make up about 80% of the state's firefighting force, and they are the first responders to about 9 out of 10 Texas wildfires. Even with Texas on fire, and as a withering drought was making more fires inevitable, the governor who wants to be your president slashed state funding for these volunteers from $30 million to an abjectly inadequate $7 million, leaving them having to spend their own money for supplies. This is Jim Hightower saying, ironically, Perry is campaigning as a states' rights small government ideologue who wants to shrink the federal role and turn governing responsibility over to state officials like him. You might ask some Texas volunteer firefighters how well such Perryism is working out in practice. This guy couldn't be trusted to run a small-town one-truck fire department, much less the United States of America.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. I think the Tea Party rally just produced probably the first "Let Them Die" cheer of the season. I guess Ron Paul was asked the question, you know, what if someone doesn't have health care? What if they can't afford it? Should we let them die? And then Paul said, no, the churches should take care of it, which, yeah, good luck on that. But I guess the crowd cheered, let them die. Is that where we're heading in the country? Is that the direction we're going? Jeb mailed me a new preamble to the Constitution, which I thought kind of interesting. He said, we, the corporations of the world, in order to form a more profitable business, establish monopolies, ensure worldwide dominance, provide for military might, promote the privileged welfare, and secure the blessings of obedience by the sheeple to ourselves and our posterity, to pervert and distort this damn piece of paper. I can't disagree with you, Jeb. I appreciate the mail. I actually sent that through the Postal Service. Thank you for helping our Postal Service. They need the business. And I suggest anybody, you know, you want to, you know, send off a letter to someone you like. They need the work. And those are jobs that I hope we can keep. Our labor moment of the day, jobless workers marched on grocery stores and seized food in Toledo, Ohio, on this day in 1932. And you saw this really across the country during that time period. Where people are going, hey, you know, we got to eat. We got to feed our kids. We've got things we've got to do. And what I find really kind of amusing is all of these people who say, we want that stinking government out of our way. The government's no good for anything. I'm sure in that situation would be quite happy to have an active government to make sure that they had something to eat. Just a thought. Our quote of the day comes from Politico. And, you know, you got to love this mentality. The Politico article said Obama is on the ropes, according to one senior House Republican aide, who, of course, requested anonymity. He said, why would we be ready to hand him a win? He said, I just don't want to come. I don't want to be a co-owner of the economy by having to tout that we passed a jobs bill that won't work or at least won't do enough. So they're basically admitting they're going to block everything they can possibly do. They've admitted that they're going to stonewall, block, obstruct, gridlock, whatever, only because this would give the president a win. If we could create jobs, get people back to work, well, the president's going to win, so we can't have that. We've got to do our politic thing. We've got to hold this up because at least it won't do enough. They're even admitting that his plan isn't enough. So the president did something today that I really didn't think he had in him. He actually wrote a piece of legislation and said, this is my bill. Pass it. There's no reason not to pass this bill, he said. And I don't see any reason why there's not, other than you've got obstructionists on the wrecking crew right. And he framed it, I think, aptly. Do we need to keep tax breaks for oil companies? Or do we need to put teachers back to work? Now, there's the Ann Coulter idea, which, again, you know, you got to wonder where the wacko right's getting this stuff.
I don't think there need to be government workers.
Okay, but I don't want to say that teachers are useless.
Yeah, no, I will. They are government workers. Let's turn it over to private, to vouchers, to charter schools. No, they fight for every last dime. They get summers off. They're off at 2, and they make more money than most of those pipe fitters who no longer have jobs.
I love Ann Coulter. When we met her in New York, she walked into the room, and the room just got really cold. A really very frigid woman, and not in any bizarre sexual way, just very her presence, very cold. But again, their idea, and this is the wrecking ball, right? This is their view of teachers. This is their view of all government employees. They're worthless. They're useless. They're no good. And those aren't real jobs. Because they actually come with health care benefits, most of them. That's why they're working so hard to destroy them. But this jobs bill, there are some parts of it that I'm not thrilled with, but there a good portion of it I think is workable. It's going to get people back to work. And that's why I think it's so important that we try. I mean, the Republicans just want to wait the 14 months, Jake. They just want to make sure that, you know, their political future is secure. They don't care about the country. They don't care about you or any of the unemployed. They see this as a win. They see it as an opportunity to really go full gung bore into their policy.
Well, when I first heard about it, I was a little disappointed in the fact that he wanted to lower the corporate tax rate, and then I heard some Democratic politicos saying, well, if the Republicans allow them to close the loopholes that the president wants to close, could be a net plus for reducing the deficit. Now, you know, long term, is what's going to happen usually happens. You reduce the rate, you close the loopholes, and then in the future, those loopholes appear again. I don't know.
But, I can guarantee they will.
But they will try, I guarantee you. But initially, it's a plus. And, you know, given the political climate, I'm not so sure that's probably the best way to do it at this point.
Well, I mean, the end game is what's politically possible, and that's what he threw out there. And look, I'll be the first one to beat up on him when he deserves beating up on. That bill that he's pushed out is a whole lot of stuff that they used to really believe in, mm-hmm. and stuff that they pushed, that they wanted. And it really kind of shows you how far to the right the Democratic Party has gone. Because now their proposal is what the Republican proposal of, you know, 5, 10, 15 years ago might have been. This investment bank, this was their baby. The private money? Oh, take over public goods? Oh, we can do that. Privatize, privatize, privatize. And I don't know if you saw this article in the Patriot News on Sunday talking about the Central Dauphin bus drivers. Eric Epstein was back in the news again, and he's saying, look, you know, the school board told the taxpayers that, hey, you're going to save $773,000 a year if we can just get rid of that busing. Get the buses outsourced. Get it to a private for-profit corporation, this Durham School Services from Illinois. You know, that's the way to go. And what Epstein's saying is, you know, instead of, you know, getting this $773,000 windfall, it's actually going to cost the school district about $300,000 more than it was paying for it. And I go back to this privatization stuff. No one can show me a scheme that's worked. No one can hold up this item and say, Rick, when we privatized the nose pickers, we saved money. No one can show me that. What they usually show me is, yes, we privatized it, and the production of snot came out, but at a much higher cost. And it costs we, the taxpayer, much more money to extract the gold, if you will. And that's basically what's going on here, and in every one of these scenarios. They come out with these eye-popping numbers. We can save $5 gazillion. And then they say, oh, well, gee, you know, that was just a projection. We didn't add in the cost of fuel, the cost of tolls, the gas, blah, blah. We didn't think of that. And now it's going to end up costing us money in the long run. So then they fall back on in the story about these Central Dauphin, you know, bus drivers being, you know, having their buses privatized. Now they fall back on, well, you know, we were going to have to go and replace our fleet, and it was going to cost us money to buy new things. So it's best that we do this, even though it's going to cost them money, over the years, and you're going to keep paying for this. And it's the exact same thing when you look at the prisons in Ohio. You know, they want to privatize the prisons, and yet they go, oh, well, it's going to cost us, I think it was $45 a day per diem for each prisoner. And over the course of over 10 years, the private for-profit corporation will make its money back three, four-fold in just 10 years. And what's amazing is they use our money to borrow from us to pay them. It's really a nice scheme. But you and I end up getting screwed. But you don't hear much about that. You know, the privatization is great. And, of course, the school board there and says, oh, it was the right decision. We never for one moment, never have we been haunted by this decision. It was the right thing to do. And I go again. Once you privatize that, there's no going back. And we don't know what 5 years, how long this contract is for one. Let's say it's 5 years. What happens in 5 years when they go, gee, you know, the price of buses have gone up, our wage structure has gone up, all these costs are going up, we're going to have to pass those on to you. And, oh, by the way, we're one of only two companies that do this. And good luck going and buying all those buses back that you sold. Congratulations on that. You're pretty much stuck. And I go back to when they privatized the trash pickup where I used to live. There before, they used to have city workers come on city trucks, and they'd pick up the trash, and it was in your taxes. I mean, it's what you paid in property taxes. It's what you paid. Then they said, well, we're going to privatize. It's going to save the city a whole bunch of money. We'll have more pickup. It'll be wonderful. You'll love it. In the first couple of years, it was great. Only cost, I think, like $110 a year. At the end of the first contract, it doubled. And then at the end of the next one, they wanted to double it again and half the amount of service you got. Because good luck. What, are you going to go buy all new equipment again? And the answer is no. And they know they've got you. Once you've privatized, once you've done away with your assets, they have got you by the short hairs, and they know it. Which is why I'm against all of these privatization schemes. They're all screw jobs waiting to happen. Have you noticed, and I brought this up before, have you noticed that there doesn't seem to be a shortage of money to tell me why PA Cyber is such a great thing? There doesn't seem to be such a shortage of money to tell me why K-12.org is a wonderful thing? There doesn't seem to be any shortage of money telling me why I need to privatize education. None whatsoever. In fact, they gave a couple of $1 million to a Democratic gubernatorial candidate who didn't have a snowball's chance in hell of winning. They just wanted to push that out there. But there's not a shortage of money. But heaven forbid you ask to pay a teacher. Heaven forbid you ask for a smaller class size. Heaven forbid you ask for a school that isn't crumbling around their children. Heaven forbid you ask for those things, because hell will freeze over before you get those. But if you want to privatize and give them brand new schools and all that, oh, we're on board, because there's a lot of money for that. Why? Because they know once they get their mitts into that, once they get their claws into the profit portion of education, it's all downhill from there. And you and I are going to pay. Anyway, let's take a quick break. Break back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. When we come back, we're going to talk about trash collection. You're not going to want to miss this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
With a PSECU home equity line of credit, you can use the equity in your house to pay for things you want. Whether it's a trip to the beach, a new deck for fun summer parties, or a little consolidation to get your bills in order, we've got a rate so low, you'll want to raise the roof. A 3.25 annual percentage rate will fit into any budget. Additional rates and terms are available. Summer's a great time to start knocking off items on your to-do list. Replace the gutters that didn't survive the storms. Make over your kitchen with new paint and energy-efficient appliances. Or maybe it's time to add a deck so you can enjoy your staycation in style. We've got fast approvals, no appraisal or credit report fee, and no prepayment penalties. Financing light is what we do best, so talk with us. For additional rates and terms, call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pscu.com/life.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280, or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Now we all ought to feel just a little bit guilty when we look into the eyes of our kids. Cause brothers, it's a fact. If we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. So the T-Twizzler debate is going on. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs are in Florida. And it's kind of interesting that they're having it at the Florida State Fairgrounds, which, again, kind of an interesting group of animals, is one of the quotes on our Facebook page. And, yeah, kind of interesting. Right where they belong, I guess. And the first boo of the debate, I guess, just happened. Ron Paul said not all Muslims are bad. That does not go with the Tea Party mantra. So he was soundly booed. Which again, Ron, you got to know the room, man. You got to play to the room. So anyway, Portsmouth, Ohio. Labor Day came, Labor Day went. Evidently, the city had sent out a notice saying, hey, to avoid overtime, we're just not going to pick it up. We're going to do something different. So, you know, please, you know, whatever. We're broke. The city's having trouble. You don't want us to raise your taxes. So we're just, you know, we're going to work some things out. So this woman, a very angry woman, and I'm going to work to try and get a hold of her because I would love to know what her voting habits are. I would love it if she was a T-Twizzler. That would just be perfect. Anyway, she evidently took her trash to the mayor's office. The mayor's name, David Malone, and she dumped it in his office. And he said that he would be happy to take it because, I want to take care of my constituents. But she was ticked off that the city didn't come up and collect her trash. And I kind of look at this and I go, if you can't miss a week of someone picking up your trash, what's going to happen when roads don't get plowed? What's going to happen when the mail doesn't get delivered? What's going to happen when you call 911 and they go, hold, please? What kind of outrage will we see? I mean, this is what happens when you starve the beast. This is what happens when you have government on its knees. And really, they are. And what's happened is we've had a tax code for so long that has gone after chop, chop, chop. We need to cut taxes at all costs. We need to make sure that those rates are low so I can get reelected, so I can say, hey, look at me. I cut taxes. Vote for me. I'm the anti-tax guy. So don't be surprised when your trash doesn't get picked up on holidays because, look, they're not paying the overtime. And don't be surprised at some point in the future if they, please hold, 911, please hold. We'll get with you in a moment. Press 1 if this is an emergency. Well, I called the line, but just wait. This is where we're heading. And I was just reading an article about the post office. Evidently, the post office is planning on, I watched this over the weekend on C-SPAN, the hearings that they had, and they're planning on doing away with some 3,700 post offices that they're going to, I guess, put in like country stores and in shopping malls and different stores. To try and privatize some of the postal services, which, I don't know one way or another. For me, it's the 250,000 jobs that will disappear. Those decent family-sustaining jobs at a time when I don't know that we can really afford even one job loss. But, again, what they're planning on doing is putting them into small country stores, which I guess for them might not be a bad thing for the country stores. But, you look at this and you go, that's... It's the end of it, man. And you look at the fact that up in Vermont, we just had Irene run through Vermont and basically wiped out most of the state. In just a couple of days, the post office was back up and running. The post office was out there delivering the mail when the private corporations like UPS and FedEx said, "Nah, we're only going to deliver to certain areas." Those ones where they're most profitable. So let's go to the phone lines. Got Jason on line one. How you doing tonight, Jason?
How you doing?
I'm good.
That's good.
What's on your mind?
I got a lot of older friends. I'm 34. I talk to them. And they constantly talk about all this stuff going on as far as, I hear stuff. They told me that there is people from China buying towns and that, and they're making their own little cities in the U.S. And I don't know if that's true or not. I thought you might know something about that, maybe.
There has been some talk of that. There are areas where they're bringing in HB2 workers to work in the factories that the Chinese corporations own. They're not their own little towns. They don't have their own little city government, but they are in those towns, and there are large numbers of them. And, yeah, there are. They've been doing that all over the country, not just the Chinese, in the Mexicans as well.
Okay. Yeah, because he's telling me, one older guy, he's a Vietnam vet, he's telling me that China's getting mad and they're wanting their money back.
Let me help you out here, Jason. China has about 9% of our debt. So when we hear the China thing, yeah, that's a lot of money, but it's only 9% of our debt. China needs us an awful lot more than we really need them. They ship all of their stuff here. If we all of a sudden one day said we're not buying any more of your cheap plastic crap, their economy would tank. So that whole – look, I don't like the fact that we've got this massive trade deficit either. But the fact that they're going to – this statement that they're going to call in their money, it ain't happening. Because they need that money as much as anybody. They're not going to sour the relationship yet. Understand where most of our money from the debt is. The debt money is mostly in Social Security. You go back to the Reagan years when they set up the trust fund. When Social raised taxes higher than any point in the history of civilization in one time, setting up this Social Security trust fund. So they were able to pot a whole bunch of money and then borrow it so they didn't run up their deficits. And that's where a lot of our Social Security money went. Star Wars, remember Star Wars?
Yep, yep.
That's where a lot of our Social Security money ended up.
Yeah.
Anything else on your mind?
Well, I'm hearing so much stuff about them cutting programs and all this crap. And why can't they cut their own pay when they give themselves a raise? And we can't, us working people out here. Because I drive a truck, I'm a truck driver. I'm gone 5-6 days a week from my home. And I'm like, just wondering, all this stuff goes through my head. I hear it on the TV all the time. Why can't they cut their pay?
Yeah, I'm in favor of them cutting their pay. But here's the thing. Here's the thing, Jason. The number one thing that has to happen in this country again, we have to organize. We have to have people joining unions again. When we had a growing, burgeoning, healthy middle class, we had 35% of the people in this country in labor unions. Labor unions are the only non-governmental entity that can stand up to corporate America. That's it. They're the only ones who can demand a fair shake and a fair share of the wealth that you create by driving on that road every day. Look, I drove a truck for years. I know the job, and I know the struggles that go with it. You know, but here's the thing. You guys are getting screwed because the brokers are screwing you over and the companies are screwing you over, and you don't have anyone standing up for you. That's why if you could get people organizing, coming together, and I know it's a tough haul, but at some point it's going to have to happen, especially when they open up that southern border and those Mexican trucks come rolling across.
Exactly. Another thing you said about the unions, my brother, brother-in-law works for Harley Davidson, and they're just cutting jobs left and right. They're bringing temp workers in and all that. And my sister always says that the company's in bed with the union and that, because they're taking holiday pay away, sick days, and all of this.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, this is a spiraling down. The union only has as much bargaining power as it has. I mean, honestly and truthfully, you're talking about 7% of the private sector workforce. If they had 35%, you would have much more power. Right now, it's not the union's in bed with the company. It's that the company's holding all the cards. The laws are on their side, and the economy's on their side. I appreciate the call, Jason.
Hey, is there a website that I can get on a list or something like that?
Certainly, the ricksmithshow.com.
Okay, hey, thanks a lot, Rick. You have a good night.
You too, man. Thanks so much. This is, in my opinion, is we need to go back to, you know, people joining labor unions again to be able to fight for some of that economic pie. It is that simple. And 5 days a week at a time, nobody should have to do that. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back, talk with Aaron Gill, I believe, right back after this.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. As President Obama pressures Congress to actually take action to create jobs, there's evidence that government spending to create jobs works. Doug Cunningham files this report.
When Obama became president, it was like becoming captain of the Titanic just after it hit the iceberg. The Bush Great Recession, the economic meltdown created by Wall Street, was causing massive jobs hemorrhage. Between December of 08 and April of 09, 3.8 million jobs were lost. 8.8 million jobs were lost by the time the recession officially ended. Now Obama is calling Congress to task to pass his American Jobs Act to create more badly needed jobs while giving tax breaks to working families and businesses and extending unemployment benefits for the millions still out of work. The kind of government action on jobs that Obama is calling for works. His 2009 $787 billion stimulus package created millions of jobs. The Congressional Budget Office says at least 1.4 million jobs were created directly by the stimulus, while as many as 3.6 million were created while stimulus money was being spent. Moody's Analytics estimates the stimulus created 2.7 million jobs. So government stimulus works. It's just that so far it hasn't been big enough to create the jobs that are needed to fully recover from the Great Recession.
One piece of President Barack Obama's jobs bill that in a less polarized Congress would easily pass is his call for an infrastructure bank. The concept has been discussed before, most recently by Senators John Kerry, a Democrat, and Kay Bailey Hutchinson, a Republican. Obama's proposal is closely based on the one the two senators introduced in March of this year. It calls for $10 billion in seed money to help get it off the ground. The president's job proposal includes $50 billion in infrastructure upgrades that the bank could oversee. The bank has the support of a wide group of unlikely allies. In March, the AFL-CIO and Chamber of Commerce stood side by side and endorsed the idea. The day after Obama's speech, a number of Wall Street bigwigs, including J.P. Morgan, also said it was a necessity. Those endorsements may not be enough for the Tea Party caucus in the House of Representatives. Minutes after the president gave his speech, House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee Chair John Micah of Florida came out swinging. He told reporters that he's strongly opposed to any type of a new federal infrastructure bank.
Workers' rights under attack. What do we do?
Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving through their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence. Your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
According to a 2011 analysis of data from the Health and Retirement Survey, they say financial assistance provided by children to their parents, regardless of the caregiver's gender or work status, is among the highest. Among adult children who are not working, 32% of men and 23% of women provide financial assistance to their parents, while among those who are working, 26% of men and 22% of women do as well. You look at this whole shifting, and that's really what the Republican wrecking crew wants to do. They want to shift the responsibility from programs that work like Social Security and Medicare onto the backs of people who can least afford it. And I look at this destruction, and I'm really troubled by the fact that Mitt Romney has been the sane one, and he's the one losing in the polls to Rick Perry, who just seems completely nuts on the Social Security and the Medicare issue, and he's not paying the price. Scary, scary stuff. Anyway, here to talk to us a little bit about Medicare and what's going on there is Allison Hirsch. She's a former college professor turned community activist. Allison, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Rick. How you doing?
I'm good. You know, I look at these attacks, and, my grandmother's on Medicare. It has saved her life numerous times, and I can't imagine what would happen if that were turned into a voucher program or some other right-wing scheme to steal that benefit from her.
You know, it is really scary. My husband's on Medicare. He's 70 now, but he had a health crisis a few years ago when he had really good insurance, employer-based insurance. He was a college professor, and he got really, really sick, and just dealing with that bills was a total nightmare for us, for me,
right.
Because he couldn't do it, you know, so I was doing it for him. And now he's on Medicare, and it's so much simpler, for one thing. You get one statement, and you know exactly where you stand, and, you know, it's a whole different way of dealing with things. But if he didn't have, and of course he lost his job after he got really sick, so without a job, without Medicare, I don't know where we would be.
You know, I look at this, and, you know, over the years, we've seen slowly Medicare being whittled down. You know, 10 years ago, if you'd have told me that we would seriously be talking about turning it into a for-profit voucher system, I would have told you were nuts. But here we are, mainstream politicians, pushing for this scheme, this ripoff,
well,
if you will.
Yeah, I guess they are mainstream politicians, but that kind of talk really is not mainstream. I mean, I got to say, I talk to a lot of seniors, and you talk to them about cutting Medicare, and they get all upset. But the irony is that that's what the Republicans did in 2010, is they used all that language about cutting Medicare against the Democrats.
Yep. It's amazing.
You know, and yet they're the ones who really want to cut it.
But if you look at all of these schemes that they've come up with, especially the Medicare Part C, which to me is really an amusing little twist, if you will. What they did is they, and I'm sure you know better than I do, what they did is they set up a private system where you, as someone who collects, who's able to get Medicare, could choose this private system, which has much better payouts, has much better access, has much better benefits, but costs us a whole ton of money more,
right.
Stealing away from Part A and Part B.
So you do Medicare Part C, you're talking about Medicare Advantage plans, right?
Right, yes.
Yeah, and you know, those subsidies that were voted in 2003, I believe, subsidies for Medicare Advantage, because the insurance company said, oh, we can do what Medicare does, but much, much cheaper, much more efficiently. And they just sold this bill of goods to Congress at the time. And Congress passed it and gave them generous subsidies, but provided that they would run out, those subsidies would start to go down as of 2010. So what happened in the last election was, people were saying, oh, Obamacare is going to cut Medicare. They didn't mean Medicare. They meant Medicare Advantage. Yep. And it wasn't Obamacare that was going to cut it. It was in that law to begin with that it was going to start, the subsidies were going to start to go down. And the insurance companies were just asking for a temporary fix. They were just saying, you know, give us a little startup money, you know, and then we'll, you know, we'll be able to make it on our own because we're so much more efficient than the federal government. Well, you know, that's baloney.
Well, it is baloney because you've got to make a profit out of it. This whole privatization scheme on anything, and I've yet to have anybody, and I've asked if there's any privatization scheme out there that you can come across that has actually saved us taxpayer money. I'd love to see it,
right?
Because I'm not, right. I'm not seeing,
yeah,
privatization.
Contractors in Iraq, right?
No, exactly.
The military contractors, that saved us a lot of money, didn't it?
Yeah, the privatization of our supply chain hasn't saved us a whole boatload of money.
Right. And the fact is, I mean, when the new healthcare law says that these big insurance companies have to spend 80% of your dollar on actual healthcare. Well, to me, that's terrible. I mean, 20% they're going to spend on overhead and CEO salaries and Super Bowl ads and, you know, all kinds of stuff. 20% they need to spend when Medicare only spends 3%.
It's amazing, you know, isn't it? And we fall for it because we've had it hammered into our head time and time again that private is better. You know, the
right.
Innovation of the free market. And look what it's done for healthcare.
Yeah. No, it's a mess. It's really a mess.
You know, I go back and I look at when I was a kid, you know, all the hospitals were community owned. We don't have community owned hospitals anymore. They're private for-profit hospitals.
Yeah. Not so many. Right.
So when,
you know, who's fighting this federal, you know, the few federal constraints that were put under the Affordable Care Act on the insurance companies. It's the big insurance lobby.
Yep.
They're the ones fighting it. The hospitals actually, you know, are on the side of the patients in this one. And they want to see health care reforms from people I've talked to.
You know, I look at I look at the Affordable Care Act, and look, there's a lot of it that I'm not thrilled with. To be honest, I would have rather had Medicare for All, open it up, affix a price to it, and tell me how much I need to pay so I can have the same benefits that my grandmother has. To me, that would have been the better way to go, but we're going this route, to appease the Republicans. That's the direction that they went, and to appease a lot of centrist Democrats.
I see more good in the Affordable Care Act than you do, but, I think the country just wasn't ready for Medicare for All, for some, you know, whatever. Maybe the other side was just too loud in their opposition to it, but, there's a lot of good stuff in the Affordable Care Act for seniors. And what it does do is it gives seniors a free wellness visit every year, which on Medicare, I mean, I'm surprised. On Medicare, you used to just get one free visit when you first signed up for Medicare. You know, and that's like the baseline. And now you get, at least you get one free visit a year, and you get free preventive care. Like if your doctor says you need a colonoscopy, then that's paid for.
But isn't that just common sense?
That's a big step forward.
I mean, shouldn't that just be common sense? And even for private insurance, shouldn't that be common sense? I mean, we used to think that way.
Yeah.
There was a guy who flew a flag in Philadelphia. What was his name? Ben Franklin. was it the whole ounce of prevention, pound of cure thing? We used to know that.
Yeah, right. That's good. Yeah. Tell the Tea Party people that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, really. I mean, we used to understand that. Somehow we've kind of lost our way.
Yeah. No. So the new healthcare law, I think, does do a lot about prevention. It does help people in rural parts of the country. There's going to be incentives for doctors to practice here. I live in Williamsport, and you know, it's a small city surrounded by a giant rural area. The whole county is pretty much rural. And we really, you know, people have a hard time finding doctors, especially in certain specialties.
Right.
But this new model will give incentives to doctors to come practice in rural areas, so that'll be a big help for us.
And there are some, look, I'm not as down on it as you may think. There are some good things to it. Doing away with rescission, doing away with, pre-existing conditions, and making sure that children are covered. I'm right there. My problem with it is it still feeds the for-profit monster.
Yeah, but a lot less. I mean, now that they get some restrictions on how much they can increase your health care costs. And when we see a little bit of it this year, for example, Highmark just raised their rates in central Pennsylvania by 9.9%. I don't know if you've done a show on this before, but 9.9%, well, you know, it's a strange number. Why not just go for 10%? Well, at 10%, then Health and Human Services at the federal level will take a closer look at them.
Yeah.
They'd have to explain themselves. Why do they need 10%? But they just, 9.9% is what they said they were going to raise it from. And unfortunately, it sounds like the insurance commissioner is actually going to take a look at that and see, do they really need that kind of increase? And that's an increase on people that are medically at risk. So it's the people who least can afford it.
Yeah, I look at all of this and I say, where are we going in this country? Because you cannot possibly lead a middle class, a reasonable, secure lifestyle if you don't have health security.
Right.
If you just don't have
access.
And I'll
tell you, in working my work that I've done for FAN, for Pennsylvania Health Access Network, I talked to so many people who can't get health care. I mean, even Medicare, I mean, it doesn't pay for dental care. I was talking to this one woman who, I swear, had two teeth in her mouth. And it was just so sad because she needed to have them pulled so she could get dentures, but she couldn't afford it. There was no, in our rural county, there's no dental help. You know, she couldn't even use her access card at the local, guy who's a dental surgeon.
Yeah, that should be criminal.
It's terrible. It's just terrible.
I mean, in what is supposedly the wealthiest country on the face of the planet, when we have things like that popping up, we had a caller, a pretty regular caller who said, look, I got a tumor in my stomach and I have no health insurance. What do I do? Where do you go?
Yeah. That is one good thing about the new law too, is the PA Fair Care program that I hope your listeners know about, and go to PA Fair Care on the Pennsylvania government website and find out information about it. It's a program for people who have a medical condition and can't buy insurance at any cost. At least for kids, then now that's prohibited under the federal law.
Right.
Kids who have a condition can now get it. The insurance company has to sell them insurance.
But at what cost?
I mean, it was a shame before that kids, who had leukemia or whatever couldn't get insurance. That's crazy.
That is crazy. But, most of the stuff that I guess is good in the Affordable Care Act doesn't kick in until, 2014?
2014, yeah. So for some people it's rough because, I mean, like for me, I'm 61, and it's that age, from 55 to 65 when your body starts to fall apart and yet you're not eligible for Medicare. And luckily I have some good health care coverage, but not everybody my age does. And that's the age people. I've talked to so many people who are just saying, you know, I just got to hang out until Medicare cuts it, you know, comes in.
Now, let me ask you about your husband, 70 years old, you know, had a couple of illnesses in the past. What would happen if today we gave you a golden ticket, we gave you a wonderful lottery winning of about $12,000 a year or $8,000 or whatever the voucher would be? Do you think you could find health care for that?
Oh, no. No way. No way. You know, absolutely not. I mean, Medicare, he had heart surgery 2 years ago, replaced the valve. I mean, he really could not walk further than a block. And this is somebody who had been healthy all his life. So it's not like he's a malingerer or something, you know. I mean, he never took a day off of work the whole time. So when he did get sick, I mean, luckily he had like a year's worth of sick days built up.
Right.
But when he did get sick, you know, and at first they didn't know what to do with him, and then finally we got him to the doctor who diagnosed him, and he got his heart taken care of. The surgery was, the bill was, then by this time he was on Medicare, thank goodness. The bill was $268,000.
Wow.
So
no one's
now that he's
that.
Got that pre-existing condition, who's going to give him insurance?
Not a soul.
You know?
Not a soul. Last question I've got for you, you know, and look, you bringing up the right-wing attack on Medicare, you know, this whole, oh, Obamacare is cutting Medicare, you know, because it's slashing
yeah,
and burning.
Baloney.
What do you want? What should seniors know? What should my T-Twizzlers know? Because, you know, that wrecking ball frame is out there, that they're stealing
right.
all this money from Medicare, and they're going to make Medicare poor. What would
yeah,
you tell
so
them?
The main thing they should know, first of all, is that the new law actually improves benefits under Medicare. It doesn't cut any basic benefits. It gives people, like I said, a free checkup. Screening and preventive services are completely free. And it pays, like my husband fell in the donut hole last year. That's when, you know, all of a sudden you're going along, you're paying for your prescription drugs, and all of a sudden you gotta pay for 100% of them. And some of these pills cost like, you know, $600 a month for one pill.
Wow.
And he takes about seven pills, and it's keeping his heart together, you know? So under the donut hole, you know, the provision in the Affordable Care Act, that's going to be paid for 50% this year, and slowly it's going to be eliminated. That donut hole, by the way, was, you know, some kind of Republican scheme hooked up in 2003 with the pharmaceutical company.
Yeah, Billy Townsend.
So, thank goodness we're getting rid of that.
Billy Townsend, I mean, that guy just, that name just rings in my head.
What's that?
Billy Townsend, the congressman from Louisiana. Who decided that, you know what, I got that Part D pushed through. I got to make sure that they can't negotiate for prices. And now I'm going to quit Congress and take that big paying job at Big Pharma.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about him.
You got to love him.
Pharmaceutical companies got what they wanted then. And, you know, they're still getting too much money for my book. But at least there's a little bit of more controls now. So, and then as far as Medicare spending, I mean, the thing is they just caught that big fraud, Medicare fraud. They busted a whole ring of people in about 12 different states or something. Medicare fraud is the way the Democrats want to cut. They want to cut out fraud.
Absolutely. And
maybe
that's
something where seniors can really help out. You know, seniors who notice something strange on their bill, like, you know, they're being billed for a prosthetic limb when they never lost the limb in the first place.
Or if they're being billed for home visits. Those are always good as well. If they're being billed for home visits, always a good one. Allison Hirsch, I appreciate the time.
Thanks so much
for the information. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show.
As governor of Texas, Rick Perry has been a 5-watt bulb sitting in a 100-watt socket. When the hot and dry tinderbox of Central Texas recently exploded into 4 raging wildfires that killed 2 people and burned 1,000 family homes down to their slabs, Perry wasn't even in his socket. He was in South Carolina campaigning for president. So he had to rush back, a day late, to pose as governor. He did a mess of photo ops and even took a political potshot at Barack Obama, blaming him for shortchanging Texas on federal firefighting help. But wait, Perry wasn't just a day late. He's been months late in providing the most basic state leadership to deal with such disasters. Texas has been ablaze with hundreds of wildfires since late last year, torching millions of acres all across the state. Yet, scrambling recklessly this spring to fill a gaping deficit he had created in the state budget, guess whose funding Perry whacked by 75%? Volunteer firefighters. Volunteer departments make up about 80% of the state's firefighting force, and they are the first responders to about 9 out of 10 Texas wildfires. Even with Texas on fire, and as a withering drought was making more fires inevitable, the governor who wants to be your president slashed state funding for these volunteers from $30 million to an abjectly inadequate $7 million, leaving them having to spend their own money for supplies. This is Jim Hightower saying, ironically, Perry is campaigning as a states' rights small government ideologue who wants to shrink the federal role and turn governing responsibility over to state officials like him. You might ask some Texas volunteer firefighters how well such Perryism is working out in practice. This guy couldn't be trusted to run a small-town one-truck fire department, much less the United States of America. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
What the hell we fighting for? Let's surrender and water down. Just got time to say your prayer. While you're waiting for a hammer to fall.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You got something on your mind, question, comment, something under your skin. You know, the big debate down in Florida with the T-Twizzlers and Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. I guess just about over. I guess it's over. Some of the clips I found hysterical, like this one from Michelle Bachmann.
We have to be an ownership society where individual responsibility, personal responsibility, once again becomes the animating American principle, and we can't be ashamed of that.
The ownership society. Boy, we haven't heard that in a while. Where does that hearken us back to? Oh, yeah, George Bush. Yes, the ownership society. The thing that got us into the whole big mess. See, we're going to have an ownership society. Everybody's going to own stuff. We're going to build an economy on owning stuff. Everybody's going to own something. And we'll give you all these neat little nifty little credit cards, and you can put little characters on it, football helmets. You can have all kind of credit cards, all of them, 7 to 8, 10 of them. You know, I've got friends who used to have like a whole playing card, a whole deck full of credit cards. And, you know, whatever the occasion was, a whole different card for whatever occasion. And, of course, they were running balances. So the Grand Ownership Society was really a credit card society. Why? Because wages have been stagnant. Wages have been going down. And like I talked about earlier, the fact that the grand newspaper of the investor class, the Wall Street Journal, has said, look, you know, in March, the home value of the middle class in this country, $6.1 trillion in equity in the homes. In 2006, that number was more than double. And I go back to, you know, what happened in 08. When the big banksters up and robbed us blind, that's what they stole. All of those mortgage-backed securities, all of those credit default swaps, all of those wonderful, complicated financial instruments. And I'll never forget it. You know, I had written an article in the one newspaper, and someone responded to it saying, "What Mr. Smith doesn't understand is that wealth is not infinite." We can create as much wealth as we want. 2 weeks later, the economy collapses because the whole thing is a house of cards. The whole mortgage thing was propped up on bad debt. And they were all in on it. And you look at the fact that, you know, people worked their butt off to put equity in those homes, to make their payments thinking, you know what, I'm going to pay this off, it's going to be mine, and I'm going to have an asset to pass on to my children, and they stole it. And I said this a number of times. I go back to the one female friend I have who, you know, 5 years into the game, man, they gave her a house she couldn't afford, hooked her up with two mortgages that no way she was going to be able to afford. If she lost a minute overtime, she was going to be in trouble. She paid 5 years, 5 years on the house. And it was almost 5 years to the date that they lost it. And anybody who's ever held a mortgage knows that those first 5 years are when you pay, the vast majority of the interest back to the bank. You don't really accumulate any equity. You're just paying to the bank. So they got all of her money, and they got her house back. Really a major, major screw job. And now you see the J.P. Morgan people, the CEO Jamie Dimon, the CEO over there at J.P. Morgan Chase, saying, you know, I don't know that I agree with all of these rules that they want to put on us. Don't think I want to be involved in the international community. I don't know that I really want to have those regulations. The Basel III capital rules is what he's talking about. And what they are is they're supposed to create an environment of increased safety. We want you to have capital reserves, something that if something bad happens, you can absorb something bad happening. And what they're saying is, you know, for the core Tier 1 banks, they have to have capital reserves of at least 7% of the risk-weighted assets. They have a little cushion. And then there's the next level, where J.P. Morgan Chase would be. They want them to have 9.5% because they're going to take on much more risk because they're bigger. And basically what they're trying to do is they're trying to get them away from being gambling houses, wanting them to go back to being banks. Investment houses should be investment houses. Banks should be banks. You go to a bank to do boring checking and, you know, mortgages and car loans and that stuff. Pretty safe, pretty secure. You go to the gambling casino to make your bets. So when you throw your money down on the gambling casino table, if you lose it, you know you lost it. But if you now your boring old bank is the gambling casino, look what it brought us. And it's right where we are. And now these big banks who I would have broken up in 2008, if it were me, I would have broken them up into smaller regional banks. There would be no J.P. Morgan Chase. There would be J.P., there would be Morgan, and there would be Chase. I would have split the whole thing. There would be just J and then P. There wouldn't even be J.P. But we didn't do that. What we did is we threw them a whole ton of money, saying, oh, please don't collapse our economy. And we're still on the hook. And who lost? You and me. It's our 401ks that got halved. It's our mortgages it's our home values that tanked. We're the ones who got screwed here. And they keep telling us, oh, but Rick, Social Security is so broken. It's broken. We're going to need to pull some of that back too. So it's not bad enough that your 401k took a shot. It's not bad enough that your house isn't worth anything. Now we're going to steal that one bit of security that maybe you had to make sure that when you get old, you're not going to live in poverty. Going to steal that away. And why? Because we don't want to raise taxes on wealthy people. And everybody agrees the fix here, anybody who's rational, I should say, the T-twits, they just want to destroy Social Security, and the Republican wrecking crew, they want to privatize it so their criminal friends on Wall Street can pocket the money and have another collapse so they can steal all of it then. The fix to Social Security is simple. Raise the cap. Raise the cap. That's simple, Dan. It doesn't get any simpler than that, Jake. Simple, simple, simple.
I agree with you, Rick. Good luck in this political climate.
But that's where it's gotta start from people like Allison. It's gotta start from people like you. It's gotta start from listeners who are going, you know what, I've had enough of this. I'm tired of getting screwed. I'm tired of working 60, 70 hours a week and not being able to put food on the table. For my truck driver friends, I'm tired of being away from home 2, 3, 4 weeks at a time. I'm tired of busting my behind and making barely minimum wage, especially when you've got a Republican Party who's saying, oh, we should do away with the minimum wage so we can create more jobs. I mean, Ron Paul. Ron Paul himself was asked.
Do you advocate getting rid of the minimum wage? Would that create more jobs?
Absolutely, and it would help the poor, the people who need a job. The minimum wage is a mandate. We're against mandates, so why should we have it? No, it would be very beneficial.
Oh, yeah, beneficial. It's going to help those poor people. See, we just want to help those poor people. Got to love that. Because we love helping poor people. We love abusing them is what we should be saying. And I look at the reality is the minimum wage should be $9.50, $10 an hour at the minimum. See, to me, a minimum wage should be what keeps you out of poverty. If you work 40 hours a week, and I'm sorry, this is just my bizarre worldview. If you go to work, you're on time every day, you bust your behind, you make someone a profit, you should not have to live in poverty. Just a thought. Just a thought. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Aaron Gill. This time it is Aaron Gill we will talk to. Pennsylvania Health Access Network. Back after this.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
My name is Precious, and I help people with mental illnesses live better lives. I work for you, the taxpayers, as a mental health case manager. People with mental illnesses can hold jobs, pay taxes, and provide for themselves. But many of them need help from social workers like me to reach their full potential. Imagine if you or someone you love needed that kind of help and had to go on a waiting list for 7 years. That's what 10 years of budget cuts have already done to mental health caseloads in our state. I know these are tough economic times, but without support services, some individuals get worse and can be a danger to themselves and their communities. And that costs all of us much more in the long run. Please contact your state legislators today and demand that they vote to increase funding for programs that help people with mental illnesses lead full lives.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our human services campaign.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask Me Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, Ask Me Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Well, I know that somewhere down inside they're just feeling small and scared. And they need to know that someone out there cares. Have you heard a Republican today? Have you tried to spread your love to those who love the NRA? Though they might be quite reluctant cause they'll wonder if you're gay.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you miss any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there. Or if you've got a smartphone, you can get the Stitcher app. Stitcher, 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 and take your class war on the go. Well, it's been 6 months since Governor Corbett ended the adult basic program, kicking a whole bunch of low-income working people off of even a very modest health insurance program, kicking them to something that was, from what I've seen, four times as expensive as the adult basic program. Here to help us work through some of it, talk about the program after 6 months being gone, what's happened to those folks, is Aaron Gill. She's a Western Pennsylvania organizer for Pennsylvania Health Access Network. PAHealthAccess.org is their website. Aaron, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
So it's been 6 months since the governor chopped these people off at the knees, these low-income workers who are getting some very modest benefits at low cost from the state. What's happened to them?
Well, that's what we thought. Most Pennsylvania Budget and Policy Center just released a report on the six-month anniversary. Only one in three people who lost coverage are known to have found other coverage. So about 30% were able to pick up special care, which is a plan offered by the Blue Cross Company, which is, like you said, four times more expensive and extremely limited coverage. You only get four doctor's visits, no prescription. If you break your leg, it doesn't cover crutches, so it's really an awful plan. So about 30% of folks picked that up. 4% were able to qualify for medical assistance, and the rest are uninsured. So they're totally shut out.
So the percentage that are covered under medical assistance, Medicaid, right? So basically what we've done then, and we kind of predicted this that would happen, you're just shifting the cost from one program to another. Did we save any money by ending the adult basic?
No, absolutely not. You know, cutting adult basic hasn't saved any money. Like you said, all it did was shift the burden. Shifted the burden from big insurance companies like Highmark and Independence Blue Cross, who could, you know, there's no skin off their back to contribute a tiny portion of their, you know, massive surpluses to keep it going. And it shifted those costs on the workers, on the communities, on the state and taxpayers, and on the safety net providers like community health clinics.
Because the people that we're talking about who were covered by this adult basic program are working people. These are folks who get up and go to work every day, but their employers don't offer health insurance, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, the kind of jobs that come with health coverage just don't exist anymore. And the ones that are out there, there's four or five people, you know, vying for those jobs. So most of the folks who lost it all basic are working one, two, sometimes three part-time jobs to try to piece together a full-time income. Or they work at low-wage, no-benefit jobs. That's the reality for most folks. And one person that we've been working with, Cindy, she works two part-time jobs, drives school bus, and works at a local small business who's barely sort of keeping their head above water. And she, you know, she's a breast cancer survivor. Needs two of those four doctor's visits for special care for her oncologist and just broke her foot. So she's literally, like, she doesn't know if she's going to lose her house. She has no idea how she's going to keep up with all this stuff. And you know, her situation is really not unique. A lot of folks are working two jobs, just really spinning their wheels, trying to maintain health coverage, and it's just becoming more and more impossible.
Yeah, I listen to that, and I often wonder what's the incentive for people who are working low-wage jobs to continue it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a nightmare. It's very, very difficult still to qualify for medical assistance. You have to be super low income. You have to have a lot of times either very young children or severe disabilities. So you can't just be, you know, poor. You know, it's very, very hard to even qualify.
So in looking at this, I mean, the governor decided, Governor Corbett decided that, you know, this program was, I don't know what the thought process that ran through his head. I don't know the man, but he decided that this wasn't something the state of Pennsylvania should be doing. We're going to push this off to a for-profit entity. And what we've seen is the rates quadruple and the services diminish. Again, another privatization scheme that has screwed the people it was supposed to help. And it's going to end up costing us, the taxpayers, more money.
It's going to cost us way more in the long term, and it already is, because when folks don't have insurance, they're forced to, you know, not get that lump checked out because, God forbid, it's cancer, and they can't afford to find out because you can't get chemo in the emergency room, which is where people are going to be forced to turn to when they don't have insurance. And those costs get passed on to hospitals, so, you know, they get passed back on to insurance companies and on to people with insurance, and then on to the state and federal government that picks up the tab for that uncompensated care. So, you know, it doesn't save any money. It's just, you know, like you said, it's just another scheme. It's another way to shift the burden, you know, and it hasn't worked. It is, you know, I wish we could say, you know, the legislature's coming back at the end of the month. I wish we could say, you know, we have reason to have faith, but we really don't. You know, the proof is in the pudding, and no one on the Republican side in the House or the Senate, and obviously the governor, who lifted a finger to help the folks who lost coverage, and they've actually been actively working against, you know, implementing the Affordable Care Act, and they've, you know, stood with insurance companies time and time again in every instance where, you know, working people really needed someone in their corner.
So you brought up the Affordable Care Act. Is there any salvation there? I know it's 2014 and it's well down the road, but is there going to be any help in that for these folks?
Definitely, definitely. In 2014, there's going to be a new insurance marketplace set up in Pennsylvania, and actually the conversations are happening right now on what that's going to look like. Fan testified at a couple of those hearings. There was one in Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, and Philadelphia. We were there, you know, advocates for working families were there, but you better believe the insurance industry was there and brokers. And, you know, they want it to be, you know, the same as our current marketplace where they have all the power. They can set the rules. They can price people out, jack up the rates. We want to make sure that, you know, this new marketplace is really strong and a watchdog for people and make sure that folks have a level playing field. So, but that's, once again, that's a decision that is going to be made by, you know, our state legislature. So we're working real hard to make sure that that new marketplace is going to be good and set up in a way that works for working families. But that's 2014. Right now there's PA Fair Care, which is a plan for folks with pre-existing conditions. You have to have been uninsured for at least 6 months before you pick that up, and a lot of folks can't afford it. It's $283 a month. So it's been a real lifeline for folks that are really sick and wouldn't have any other options. But a lot of the folks who lost it all basic just can't afford that premium. Right. So one thing we can do in Pennsylvania, and that's what we're doing right now, we talked about special care. It's already four times more expensive, but Highmark, and this is, you know, it was really just a slap in the face. They, at the beginning of August, filed to raise rates by 9.9% on that plan. So we petitioned, because technically, and a lot of folks don't know this, but for individual plans and plans sold by nonprofit insurance companies like UPMC and Highmark, the public technically has 30 days to comment to the insurance department when they want to raise rates. So we collected almost 3,000 petition signatures, delivered them to the insurance commissioner, had folks call into their office and to the governor saying we oppose this rate hike. And Highmark just last week announced that they were dropping that to 4.9% instead of 9.9%, which we're still opposed to that. But that's, you know, we want a public hearing so that we can ask them, you know, why can you drop $3 million on a Super Bowl ad, but you have to raise rates 9.9%, and all that would bring in is like $2.6 million. So we want to have a public hearing to really put them on the spot and show that they don't need to raise the rates. So yeah, that's something we can do, you know, concretely right now to stop this increase. And we could do that, you know, we need stronger protection so that people can do that whenever an insurance company wants to raise rates, and that would help keep rates more affordable.
And what you've just laid out is, I mean, I think a message for folks to get active and to be involved in not only the issue, but the community in which they live, so that they can do things like you just said. Go to these, yeah, these hearings and testify about these rate, these outrageous, I mean, 9.9%. I don't know how you can justify that.
No, you can't justify it at all, and that's the thing. That's why Highmark is, that's why we think they dropped the increase to 4.9, so they could avoid a public hearing. And that's the thing, is like the public, it's killed by these rate increases all the time. Small businesses especially, or people that are self-insured, especially folks that insurance companies don't want to take, who are lower income, who might have a pre-existing condition, I mean, just getting gouged all the time. So it's really important to have hearings. It's really important to have an insurance department that actually works for the people and not the industry. And, you know, we don't really have that right now. So we're working real hard to put some pressure on them to start doing the right thing.
I would guess our insurance commissioner's a former industry executive.
Yes, worked at a law firm, I think most recently, but definitely comes from the industry background, and was appointed by Governor Corbett, who hasn't, you know, has had an awful track record when it comes to health care.
So again, when you vote for a governor and you you got this pro-business mentality, this is what you end up with. We're business friendly now. We're very business friendly. So in looking at these folks who are working, these low income jobs, but and their employers don't offer health care, we got to figure out a way to get these folks to 2014. And you know, I look at what they've done, and I don't know that what they've done is the answer. I think it's what it has done is it's made the situation worse.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's just getting worse, and we really have to get there to 2014. But this, you know, if we can, you know, put a little sunshine on some of these rate hikes, that's one concrete thing we can do in Pennsylvania to keep rates reasonable between now and then. But unfortunately, you know, the best advice I would have for folks who are uninsured now, you know, the first thing is definitely get politically active. Just, you know, you're not alone. I think sometimes people are ashamed or they feel like maybe it's my fault, but the kind of jobs that offer coverage aren't out there, so people have nothing to be ashamed of. And they should be beating on their legislator's door saying, hey, I'm doing everything right. I'm working my tail off, and I'm still getting shut out. I don't have affordable coverage. You need to really put your foot to the gas pedal and make sure the Affordable Care Act is implemented and not picked apart. So, you know, get politically active, get connected with us, and also, you know, utilize local health clinics. There are some, and we have this up on our website, but there are a lot of different sort of piecemeal things like discount prescription drug programs and different plans, and sort of you can sort of patchwork together to maintain some level of care between now and 2014. But people shouldn't have to do that. You know, if everybody should have access to health care in this country. So it's a shame that that's where we are, but we want to make folks aware of all the resources that are out there.
And the website is pahealthaccess.org. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Aaron Gehl's name. It'll take you right there. Aaron, I appreciate the time, and I appreciate the passion. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Working class.
need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one? Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211. You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well? Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211. How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave? Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211. Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike. Call him at 243-3211. You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too. So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211. Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings. That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
I'm ready to do what has to be done for the next generation, with the courage to fight for freedom, with the courage to fight for America. That's why I'm announcing today that I'm running for president of the United States.
And when your looks are gone and you're alone, how many nights you sit beside the phone? What were the things you wanted to do?
Well, you know, the big heat of the moment was tonight during the T-Twizzler debate. And, you know, I mean, you can only see so many of these before you realize that they're all just weird. There's not a decent candidate among them. And nothing changes. They just try and... I guess they pick one guy and they go after him for a little bit, and I guess Rick Perry is the flavor of the month, and a lot of people are now, Romney's come around to Social Security going, oh, we need to save it. In fact, he had his little hit piece going after after Perry. And look, I think Perry's just flat out nuts. I think there's a whole lot of crazy going on there, and if we do elect someone like him president, we are in a world of trouble. We will be pining. We will be pining on our knees for George W. Bush. We'll be pining for the days of the ownership society. It's just that simple. And I love Michelle Bachmann. I mean, this ownership society, I don't know that I would have gone with this frame. I just don't know.
We have to be an ownership society where individual responsibility, personal responsibility, once again becomes the animating American principle, and we can't be ashamed of that.
Yeah, I mean, we need that ownership society again. And so we looked up the timeline of the phrase ownership society, and this is purely a George W. Bush construct. The first time it has been recognized in the history of the world. I mean, this is really a pretty amazing thing. The first time in the history of the world was George Bush put ownership society together back in 2001. To me, that's remarkable. In fact, he's one of only two or three people who've ever put that in a sentence. I mean, that's remarkable when you think about it. All the words that have ever been spoken together. Google timeline comes up with, he's the only guy.
Well, your girlfriend, Michelle, I think her handlers understand that she's got to hit a home run tonight or she's going to slip into insignificance.
I think
she's trailing and her numbers are falling and she needs to, in her own handler's mind, I'm sure they realize that they not only have to stop that fall, she has to do something dramatic tonight. And I think that's what they're going for.
And she didn't. And, you know, the reality in this is, look, she's trying to occupy the same space that now Perry has taken up, which, again, is why I don't think Sarah Palin's going to jump into this. I don't think she can. I don't think she can out Tea Party Perry. I think he's now full fledged their guy. Even though there's some problems with him, I think he's their guy.
Well, if these two guys, it appears that it could be a race between Romney and the governor. There appears to be some sanity,
which
regrettably, in the Republican Party that's saying I'm not so sure that Mr. Perry can. Governor Perry can get elected, and I concur with that. I really don't believe, even though George Bush got elected, and I was absolutely amazed that he got elected the second time, unfortunately for the country.
When you can fix the votes, there's no amaze.
My point is this. I really believe that this guy is so radical, and he has. I think that his statements on Social Security is going to be an albatross around his neck. I wouldn't be surprised that he falls in his face in Florida. You know, that's almost a given, given the huge amounts of people down there in Social Security. He's going to have a problem, especially in the general, explaining that.
Well, here's the thing. And I look at this new CNN poll. 52% of respondents over 65 say Perry is their choice for president. 21% say choose Romney. 65 and over, 52%.
Those are Republicans or just?
Those are Republicans.
Republicans, well, they're.
Now, you stop and you think about what you just said, that, you know, the seniors are going to be weirded out. And I'm saying the Republicans have gone so far to the extreme that even when they're in their own interest being screwed, they still see ideology over that. It's just very bizarre. I mean, this CNN poll really kind of way out there, and what it's shown is Perry's way out ahead of Romney, and Romney's got to do something to gain that back. And the problem is the party has moved. I think, you know, the Republican voters have moved so far to the extreme that I don't think Romney can out extreme him. This isn't about beating Obama. This is about winning the Republican primary. And that's where I think Romney's got a problem.
Well, maybe we're forgetting one factor, and maybe they're not going to be a real force. But what about Wall Street? What about big business?
I don't think Wall Street cares. I think look what Perry's done in Texas. Created more jobs than any other state minimum wage jobs. Good business friendly minimum wage jobs. I think he's business's guy too. He'll go where the money tells him to go. I don't think they got a problem with him. I think Wall Street might worry about Romney having a thought of his own, because he likes to fashion himself as someone who understands how the economy works, and we're going to make this a job machine. And, you know, he may not go with Wall Street. As for Perry, he's just a puppet on a string, man. Well, tell me where you want me to go. Throw me the cash. That's my thought.
Well, and then we have the third option. Somebody out there who hasn't been named yet, who hasn't come out.
Well,
and
Christie may be the guy.
That could happen.
And I don't think it's going to, though. At this point, I'm not sure. But if Christie did, he would be the flavor of the month, and he would be under the gun. But if he did, I think he would pop to the top. But here again, you know, it's about beating Obama down the road, and I don't think any of this field can do that. You know, especially when you look at the polling numbers. I just don't see it. I think what bothers me is, I talked about this earlier, the Politico piece, and this is what the Republicans are betting on. They're betting on the economy staying crummy. They're betting their fortune on this economy not recovering. They are going to obstruct. They're going to delay. They're not going to pass this jobs bill that Obama put forward. And if they do, it's going to be well past time to really do anything for the next election, and they're going to make sure of that. Because they're already coming out saying, well, we're not going to do that. Well, we don't want more stimulus. We want to go our route, which is cutting government jobs, cutting spending, so that we lose more jobs, cutting consumption. Because understand, when they take that money out of the economy, and it may sound great, hey, oh, we're gonna cut a bunch of government spending on those workers. That used to be money that was spent in the economy that created private sector jobs as well. Once you pull that out, you're going to start seeing that spiraling down where you're going to lose jobs all across the economy. Not to mention, we're going to have to be paying out unemployment benefits. and all of the things that go with that. And then all of the negatives, the foreclosures, the loss of health care, all of that stuff. So if we go the Republican route, if we go the wrecking crew route, there's only one way to go with them, and that's down. It's down even further.
You talked around the turnaround. Where does it end? Perhaps some of the numbers indicate that the American people are beginning to understand what the Republicans are about. I think the Republicans have been, when they went home, they got a mouthful, an earful. I think they're looking at the polls. I think they're talking to some advisors, and they're realizing that they have to take a little bit of the edge off their message, and now they're not saying outright from an hour after the president makes a proposal, they're saying absolutely not. If you notice, they backed off. Boehner and some of the leaders backed off a little bit. I think the realization is that they gotta change their act. I don't think they're gonna ultimately change their position, but I think the polls and the message that they're getting from their constituents, I think alarms them a bit. Now, is that going to be enough for them to change their mind? Probably not, but at least I think the American people are starting to get awake to exactly what the Republican Party stands for.
Well, from what I've been seeing coming out of the politicians' mouths themselves, I'm not seeing that. What I'm seeing is them saying, you know, we're basically staying the course. We'll work together. Well, sure. Bet your bottom dollar on that. Because you look at what Obama put out last week. You look at that jobs bill. A lot of Republican red meat. I mean, lots of the investment bank? Really? That's a privatization boom. Hey, we can start privatizing all of our infrastructure by getting private money. And oh, what? We'll throw public money in so the private corporations can profit off of our money. It's basically a P3 scheme. More public-private partnerships that benefit the private interests. And, you know, there's part of me that goes, you know, yeah, I'm okay, we'll do it, but we better have enough rules in place that we don't get screwed. But again, the Republicans, they don't want any regulations on this. They want to be able to use our money freely to benefit their buddies. And
but those are the kind of things, Rick, and you could say it's politically motivated. I think some of it is, but I think some of it is just pragmatism for them to have any chance at all. Either to get it through or, in the long run, probably what's more important is to show the American people, show those people in the middle, the moderate voters, that, look, these are moderate proposals, and even that the Republican Party is saying no. And I think that's what it was geared for. Well, and you're right. It was a very moderate proposal.
He gave him their trade agreements, which, again, I'm against. And all he asks for is all the workers who are going to lose their jobs, we give them a little extra help. We allow them to retrain for jobs since those are going to go away. That's pretty much admitting. And now the White House keeps saying these trade agreements are going to create 250,000 jobs. I don't know where that number came out of. All I can think of is it came out of the dark side of the moon. They reached behind themselves and popped out a number. 250 sounds like a nice round number. So they plucked that right out of the dark side of the moon there and threw it out there. The numbers that I've been seeing are 150,000, 160,000 jobs lost. Now, if the Republicans really believe that their free trade creates jobs, why not throw that in there? Say, fine, we're so confident that these free trade agreements are going to create as many jobs as we can possibly make them create, that we're going to make sure that one guy, because there may be one guy who loses his job, we're going to make sure he's okay. They're not saying that, because everybody knows, both Democrat and Republican, they know these are job killers. These are going to cost us down the road, but what they do is they fill the pockets of the investor class. They fill the pockets of the financiers. They fill the pockets of Wall Street. They're going to screw you and me. I mean, we're done in this. These trade agreements go through, you and I are done. They will move more, not as bad as NAFTA, not as bad as CAFTA, not as bad as the thing they're trying to pull over in Asia once they open up that market. But we're going to lose jobs. It's that simple. Anyway, I'm going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You got a question, comment, and call us. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I answer all emails personally. Right back after this. Stick around.
Why? is The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. As President Obama pressures Congress to actually take action to create jobs, there's evidence that government spending to create jobs works. Doug Cunningham files this report.
When Obama became president, it was like becoming captain of the Titanic just after it hit the iceberg. The Bush Great Recession, the economic meltdown created by Wall Street, was causing massive jobs hemorrhage. Between December of 2008 and April of 2009, 3.8 million jobs were lost. 8.8 million jobs were lost by the time the recession officially ended. Now Obama is calling Congress to task to pass his American Jobs Act to create more badly needed jobs while giving tax breaks to working families and businesses and extending unemployment benefits for the millions still out of work. The kind of government action on jobs that Obama is calling for works. His 2009 $787 billion stimulus package created millions of jobs. The Congressional Budget Office says at least 1.4 million jobs were created directly by the stimulus, while as many as 3.6 million were created while stimulus money was being spent. Moody's Analytics estimates the stimulus created 2.7 million jobs. So government stimulus works. It's just that so far it hasn't been big enough to create the jobs that are needed to fully recover from the Great Recession.
One piece of President Barack Obama's jobs bill that in a less polarized Congress would easily pass is his call for an infrastructure bank. The concept has been discussed before, most recently by Senators John Kerry, a Democrat, and Kay Bailey Hutchinson, a Republican. Obama's proposal is closely based on the one the two senators introduced in March of this year. It calls for $10 billion in seed money to help get it off the ground. The president's job proposal includes $50 billion in infrastructure upgrades that the bank could oversee. The bank has the support of a wide group of unlikely allies. In March, the AFL-CIO and Chamber of Commerce stood side by side and endorsed the idea. The day after Obama's speech, a number of Wall Street bigwigs, including J.P. Morgan, also said it was a necessity. Those endorsements may not be enough for the Tea Party caucus in the House of Representatives. Minutes after the president gave his speech, House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee Chair John Micah of Florida came out swinging. He told reporters that he's strongly opposed to any type of a new federal infrastructure bank.
Workers' rights under attack. What do we do?
Pacifica Radio says it's riveting. This is what democracy looks like. Wisconsin's Worker Uprising is a one-hour documentary from Madison-based Workers Independent News. Get your copy today at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
So here it comes, the moneyed interests diversion. The folks over at the Heritage Foundation, the Heritage Action for America, their chief executive officer, Michael Needham, he wrote, basically your basic, hey, give us money so we can keep fighting those workers. He wrote last night, the president, this is after the president's speech, so on Friday this came out. Last night, the president of the United States said he wanted to see more products made in America. This from a president who has allowed his National Labor Relations Board to torture a great American company, Boeing, trying to make planes in America. And, you know, he said he wanted to pass trade agreements, but he had to pay off his labor union buddies. And he goes on to talk about the stimulus, that it was wasted, you know, the $800 billion stimulus that Obama wasted. Another blank check, he writes, for radical left-wing agenda. And I look at this and I'm going, you know, this is the right-wing talking points. National Labor Relations Board, here's your shiny thing. Keep focusing on that. Don't focus on the fact that Boeing is breaking the law by doing what they're doing. Never mind that. And of course, focus on destroying the only entity capable of stopping corporate America from continuing to abuse its employees. and steal from their wages and their benefits. Go after those evil unions. And, of course, we can't have another stimulus because, heaven forbid, that he actually creates jobs. That's the thing. That's what they're trying to push. And, you know, I was talking with a guy earlier this morning when I came into the studio, and I was going, you know what amazes me is how the right has done a masterful job of convincing people like the guy I was talking to who worked on the garbage truck and convincing us that cutting spending, cutting teachers' pay, cutting jobs, all of this stuff is somehow good for us. Cutting Social Security, privatizing Medicare, going after privatizing Social Security, all of this is somehow good for us. It's the medicine that we need. Not saying, hey, I would like some of the profit that I create, please. No, not that at all. Not saying I'm not going to make another dime for you until I get a portion of it. That's not it. But they do a nice job pushing this frame and constantly with their language, because, of course, the National Labor Relations Board is torturing. It's a good right. It's a good right wing word, isn't it? Torturing. They're torturing Boeing. Boeing's a good American company, and they're torturing them. Yeah, by making them follow the law. That's torture, Jake. Absolute torture.
Gives you, I don't know, a mental picture of drawn quartering. Are they tying the executives up with, you know, ropes to four horses and pulling their bodies apart? Is that what you're referring to?
I think there are some that would not mind that. and there's some that would not mind seeing that. But the Republicans are running on this platform. And, you know, the big debate tonight, every one of them on the stage is all in favor of making the U.S. a right-to-work nation, which, you know, sounds great. We should have the right to work. And I agree. Everyone should have the right to a job. You won't hear them say that. You won't hear them say that you have a right to that job. No. You have the right to work for low wages, no benefits, no say in what happens in a third of your life. You know, no voice, no freedom, no safety, no whatever. That's the kind of nation they want. And look, at the end of the day, you know, I've had some people say, well, Rick, you make it sound like every employer is a bad employer. And that's not the truth. There are some that are really, really bad. And there are some that are really, really good. And you know what? The some that are really, really good, I have found that they encourage unions to come in and organize their workers so that they feel empowered to actually participate and actually, in a way, not feel fear to speak their mind. See, there are two different ways of looking at a union in your workplace. Two different ways. There's an adversarial way and a partnership way. What the Republicans love to do, they love to prop up that adversarial relationship. The boss and the worker button heads and that union guy button heads and making things difficult. In fact, Romney just came out with a video, which is another beautiful piece of propaganda. And, you know, these union people came in and, you know, with this, and they wanted to ruin my business and my workers. We stood against them. And it's ridiculous. I mean, plain nonsense. But they play that adversarial relationship. They don't talk about the building trades who actually go out and find their contractors' work. They don't talk about the building trades who actually go and picket at projects that are being done by non-union companies who can't possibly complete the work on time and on bid. They don't talk about that. They don't talk about how they help their contractors. No, because there's a partnership there. And why don't we think that way? Well, because the moneyed interests, the big corporations, the Koch brothers and the Walmarts, they want you to focus on that teamster with a baseball bat. That's what they want you focusing on. That they're big thugs. And, you know, I went to Wisconsin thinking, wow, there are going to be a lot of thugs and there's going to be some ruckus and some chaos. And, you know, and what did I find? I found Granny handing out cookies. A 91-year-old woman saying, look at me, the face of a union thug. The Republicans don't want to talk about that. The right-wing wrecking machine, they don't want to talk about that. What they want is they want you focused on the adversarial relationship. And what they want to do is they want to go and destroy the National Labor Relations Board. Because this is one entity that they cannot control. They had it controlled quite well during the Bush years. They were able to, some of the decisions that came out during the Bush years would make your toes curl. But now they go, well, geez, they're going to actually use the National Labor Relations Board to do what it was meant to do, and that's protect workers' rights? Really? They're going to do that? So now the Republicans have said, well, we're going to fix that. We're going to come out with House Bill 2587. And I love the name. You got to give the right-wing wrecking machine credit. They always come up with such nice, colorful names. The Protecting Jobs from Government Interference Act of 2011. Protecting Jobs from Government Interference. And what it's going to do is it's basically going to give them the ability to strip the National Labor Relations Board to do anything. It says, quote, they want to amend the National Labor Relations Act by inserting before the period and at the end of the following, provided further that the board shall have no power to order an employer or seek an order against an employer to restore or reinstate any work, product, production line, or equipment, to rescind any relocation, transfer, subcontracting, outsourcing, or other change regarding the location, entity, or employer who shall be engaged in production or other business operations, or to require any employer to make an initial or additional investment in a particular plant, facility, or location. Section 3 of the bill, retroactivity, the amendment made by Section 2 shall apply to any complaint for which a final adjudication by the National Labor Relations Board has not been made. So basically, retroactive. Going to go back and undo all that Boeing stuff. Because this is Boeing's baby. They came out and they said, look, we're moving to South Carolina because you people went on strike. We are retaliating against you for your right to strike. That, my friends, unless I'm wrong, Jake, is against the law. That is blatantly breaking the law.
Absolutely correct.
So this has nothing to do with it. So now they're giving them the out. They're going to go and they're going to strip the board of any power to do this, and they're going to do it in a retroactive fashion. I wish I had enough money, since Boeing is now a person, because evidently now corporations are people, according to Mitt Romney and the Supreme Court. If I create a crime, can I get a retroactive deal like Mr. Boeing is getting? Can I go and have the law changed to make sure that what I've done is no longer against the law? Which is kind of the business community's idea of we're not breaking the law. The laws are broken. They don't fit to our needs. So we need to reform those laws so that the criminal activity that we're doing now is legal in the future. I mean, really, I wish I had that kind of power. I wish I had that kind of campaign money. And the reason I bring that up, we're in the middle of a pretty serious economic downturn. We've got millions of people unemployed. The unemployment rate's over 9%. And I see this article in the New York Times. And there are the title is Louisiana Business Owners Sue Over New Wage Rules for Guest Worker Program. Yes, we're still bringing in guest workers. Thanks to George W. Bush, employers can now bring in up to 66,000 non-agricultural foreign workers on an H-2B visa. So if you can say, hey, you know what, there's nobody who's willing to do this job at the crappy wages that we're paying with no benefits, and it's really dangerous, let's go get some of them foreigners and bring them in and pay them virtually nothing in really crummy conditions. And, of course, the Bush administration streamlined the application process to make sure that these employers could do it. Because before Bush, it was kind of cumbersome, as difficult, because, you know what, we actually wanted Americans hired. We actually wanted people in the neighborhood, you know, thought it would be a good idea to hire locals. Didn't think it was such a great idea to go several hundred miles away to pull exploitable workers from another area. Thought we had some people here we could use. But evidently, you know, we have this Louisiana Food Association, who a number of small businesses, be it, alligator cutters. I guess they cut up alligator meat. They shuck the oysters, shells, and shell crabs, and all this stuff. Process, Bubba Gump shrimp, Forrest Gump had the shrimp place. So you needed all these cheap exploitable workers to come in and bust their behind for piecemeal work. Well, what they're saying is if you do this, if you make us actually pay those people a minimum wage, well, we're gonna have to go out of business. And I'm going, if your business model is set up on using less than minimum wage labor from out of the country, maybe we should be looking at your business model. But here at the end of the month, they're going to have to pay these guest workers, you know, at the crawfish and the shrimp processing plant. They're going to have to pay them from 50 to 80% of the currently hourly rates. Now, they're going to have to pay them more. So how little are they making? If you're paying them anywhere from 50 to 80% more to get the minimum wage, are they making $3.50 an hour? I mean, really? Is that a model that you think we should have in this country? But that's what the Republicans are pushing. This is their world. And the Ron Pauls of the world will say, well, you know what? We've got people here doing that job, shucking shrimp and cutting alligator and doing all kinds of these really dangerous jobs where maybe half of them have eight fingers. There are people who are willing to do it for $3 an hour. We should get rid of that minimum wage so we can have more workers doing it for $3 an hour. In fact, those people who are making minimum wage, we can drop them down to $3 an hour. Think how much more profit they'll be. That's the right-wing dream, folks. That is it in a nutshell. And these are the people that we voted for.
I guess the question is there any bottom line in his world? Is there any amount too small?
No.
If they want to work for 50 cents an hour, that's okay in his world?
Yep. You know, look, I had an economics professor in college who was a big free marketeer. And he said, you know, what we need to do in order to keep full employment rates in this country, and this is the right-wing ideology. This is what they've been taught. This is what they believe. In order to beat the mechanization, in order to not have an employer at the chocolate factory, for instance, use technology to build more machines or faster machines or bigger machines, in order to make you more useful, you had to drop your wage down. So if it were cheaper for him to buy a machine than it is for him to pay you a dollar an hour, he's going to buy the machine. So you should work for 50 cents an hour so he doesn't. That's their worldview. Because that's what you're worth to them. That's the business-friendly model. That's the mentality of the Ron Pauls of the world. It's the free market. And if your work, if what you do is worth only 50 cents an hour, that's all you should be paid. And that's what they believe. That's no way to run a society, but that is what they believe. Because, you know, how much is a brain surgeon worth? If he's going to save your life, how much is he worth? That's the other end. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this. Stick around.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
As governor of Texas, Rick Perry has been a 5-watt bulb sitting in a 100-watt socket. When the hot and dry tinderbox of Central Texas recently exploded into 4 raging wildfires that killed 2 people and burned 1,000 family homes down to their slabs, Perry wasn't even in his socket. He was in South Carolina campaigning for president. So he had to rush back, a day late, to pose as governor. He did a mess of photo ops and even took a political potshot at Barack Obama, blaming him for shortchanging Texas on federal firefighting help. But wait. Perry wasn't just a day late, he's been months late in providing the most basic state leadership to deal with such disasters. Texas has been ablaze with hundreds of wildfires since late last year, torching millions of acres all across the state. Yet, scrambling recklessly this spring to fill a gaping deficit he had created in the state budget, Guess whose funding Perry whacked by 75%? Volunteer firefighters. Volunteer departments make up about 80% of the state's firefighting force, and they are the first responders to about 9 out of 10 Texas wildfires. Even with Texas on fire, and as a withering drought was making more fires inevitable, the governor who wants to be your president slashed state funding for these volunteers from $30 million to an abjectly inadequate $7 million, leaving them having to spend their own money for supplies. This is Jim Hightower saying, ironically, Perry is campaigning as a states' rights small government ideologue who wants to shrink the federal role and turn governing responsibility over to state officials like him. You might ask some Texas volunteer firefighters how well such Perryism is working out in practice. This guy couldn't be trusted to run a small-town one-truck fire department, much less the United States of America.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Also, if you missed any portion of the program, you can download it there at the website. We've got our podcast up. And also, if you've got a smartphone, you can download the Stitcher app and take the program anywhere you want to go. Also, you can email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. I do answer all emails personally. I got one a little bit ago saying, hey, you know what? During the segment of news brought by Ellen, there was a discussion that the U.S. Senate passed some bill that would have provided the Pentagon funding without having to come to Congress. You asked if it was constitutional. He says, no, it ain't. He says Article 1, Section 8, right below giving Congress the power to declare war is to raise and support armies, but no appropriations of money. To that you shall be for longer term than 2 years. And he points out that, you know, during World War II, they only appropriated money from 41 to 43, and went on from there. So, I didn't think it was constitutional. Neither did she, if I remember correctly. And I'm not quite sure what it was that she was talking about. But, you know, I don't think it is. And if it's one of these things where, again, Congress is abdicating its responsibility, I got a real problem with that. And we all should. Interesting news coming out on student loans. The number of borrowers defaulting has risen sharply. And again, one of those things where we talk about, how do you get into the middle class? How do you get and stay in the middle class? Well, you get a good education. Isn't that what they tell you? Go get an education. This way you'll have an opportunity to get a good job. Well, we've got all these people out here who have college degrees, can't find jobs because they're not there. So how do you stay in the middle class? Then you end up taking on massive amounts of debt that once you get out, can't find a job, can't pay back. And, of course, student loans are those special kind of loans that you can never default on. They're like herpes. They stay with you forever. And there's no forgiveness in sight. And in fact, some of the numbers are really just way out of hand. In fact, the national 2-year default rate rose to 8.8% last year from 7% in 2008, according to figures released Monday by the Department of Education. AP says the latest figures show the percentage of the more than 3.6 million borrowers whose first payment came due at the start of October 2008 at the height of the crisis, defaulted before September 30th, 2010. So, again, all these people who thought they were doing the right thing, I'm going to go to school, I'm going to get a good education, I'm going to get a job that's going to pay me a reasonable middle-class existence, and I'll be able to pay those loans back because, after all, I am investing in myself. I am taking money and I am investing in me. And I ask the question because, you know, it's a common sense question. If we want to have a society of of people who are entrepreneurs, and we want to have a society of people who are inventors and tinkerers and you know, thoughtful people. We want to have an educated, society, not just workforce. Don't you think we would spend some money on education? I mean, just a thought. I mean, you look at the countries like Germany that are spending tons of money. I mean, tons of money educating their workforce so their skills are the highest, most qualified workforce in the world. And I look at this thing with the trade agreements. Explain to me the sense in saying, okay, well, we're going to lose some jobs, but we're going to gain some new ones. Some high-skill, high-tech manufacturing jobs that are very precise, that need specialized training. Why in God's name would you not appropriate the funding for your workforce to be able to fill that gap? It makes no sense. Well, wait a minute. It does. It does. We don't want to have to pay those people. We want to be able to say, you know what? There aren't people who are capable of doing those jobs. We have to move them to China or Malaysia or places where they actually train people to do these jobs, since we don't, Jake. I mean, to me, we've got all this money to destroy public education. We've got all this money to advertise for PA Cyber and for K-12.org. Got all this money. It's all there, piles of it. But we don't have the money to train our workforce.
In the end, it's all about profit, maximizing it. Unfortunately, all too often, what's good for corporate America is not good for America.
And you look at the census data that was released recently. They're continually going through these census numbers. You know, who's got college educations? What's their income level? The whole reason you do the survey is so they can come up with statistics and they can come up with policy ideas. What worked in the last 10 years? What didn't? And the trends that we've seen is people with college educations, they do pretty well. The average income of a college graduate and a high school dropout was something like five times the annual rate. I mean, it was a number really outrageous. I think it was like $72,000 a year or something. Really, just completely outrageous between someone with an advanced degree and someone who dropped out of high school. Now they're saying, look, if you drop out of high school or if you barely have a high school education, you're not going to make it. There are no more of those jobs, sweeping floors or doing manual labor out there where you're going to be able to make a family-sustaining wage. We've simply given those jobs away. And what we're saying is, look, we need to make sure that that people have the opportunity to get an education. And what you're seeing, especially with our right-wing wrecking crew, they want to take that opportunity away. Because if you don't have that ladder to get that education, what's going to happen to you? Where do you go?
Good question.
And, I was just reading an article in the investor class newspaper because I get the Wall Street Journal because I want to know what the investor class thinks of us lowly people. And, they go through and they're talking about the middle class. How the wealth class, the very wealthy areas, pay their teachers very well. And per student spending is extremely high. And in the poor neighborhoods, we as a society have said we want to try and help those who are disadvantaged to come up. So teacher pay is pretty good there. Average student, per student rate is pretty high. It's not the wealth class number, but it's not pretty high. And they focused on the middle class. They're saying, look, the middle class areas who are reliant on property taxes that are stagnant, are relying on folks who their incomes are actually dropping to pay the bill. They're the ones who are being squeezed. These middle income districts are being squeezed. Bigger classes, less services, lower teacher pay, lower per student spending. So what they're afraid of, and this is the investor class's newspaper saying this. Those middle class kids, they're the ones who are being screwed out in all of this, because these school districts are doing everything they can do to cut and cut and cut because they don't want to raise taxes. They don't want to have to pay for what the education. And what's happening is the number of middle income kids who are able to go to college are getting screwed. And this is where I agree with the Tea Party people. When you go into a disadvantaged area and they have more resources and they have the ability to get more financial aid than someone who's trying to make ends meet and busting their behind, not that the people in the poor areas are not. I'm not saying that. But when you don't get the shot that someone else gets, I can see how people get upset. And again, I focus my attention on the very wealthy folks who they could easily pay, but don't. Which again comes back down to the way we fund education in this country.
Well, I mean, Rendell took a lot of criticism, and he certainly wasn't a perfect governor. But I like one of his proposals. He said, "Why don't we have state funding back to individual school districts from the state?" Well, you know, politically, that's not very palpable, because you know what will happen. The wealthy school districts will have to share a little of that wealth, and they're opposed to that.
Well, that and what would happen is you would end up seeing that money absorbed into the treasury, and you'd start to see education spending drop, especially at a time like we have now with a Republican governor and a Republican legislature.
Well,
look what they've done to education already.
You would have to put up a box if that's possible. In today's political environment, we would have to make sure that money allocated for education goes to education. And I know that's not always easy, but the concept does make sense.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, to me, there are a whole bunch of common sense things that could be done that are not going to happen because they're intent on destroying the system. And as I've said, there's plenty of money. There's plenty of money to go into destroying it. There's plenty of advertising dollars to push diversions. There's plenty of that out there. But I don't see anybody advertising your local public high school a good place to go, or your local elementary school the best of all worlds. I don't see the advertising campaign to make my local elementary or middle or high school look like the best option. I'm not seeing that. Why? Because they don't have the money. Explain to me. I wish someone could come up with a rational reason why we have to advertise PA Cyber and why all of this money is for K-12.org. Somebody explain it to me because I am not getting it. I say we take that advertising money, put it right back into education and fix the problems we have with public education and stop this insanity of taking us down the road to destruction. Just nuts. And I look at somebody like the leader of the Republican wrecking crew, this Daryl Issa. A multimillionaire in his own right. Public education, not something he's all that concerned about. But he went after teachers. He said, "I don't think we should maintain government workers with borrowing because the president wants to put a little bit of money back in the state so we don't end up laying off so many teachers. Because heaven forbid, that a class size be less than 40 or 50. But here again, this is a guy, one of the most powerful guys in the House, saying, "You know what? We don't want to do that. We don't care about that. Let them go." Nuts. Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
Can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Sitting at the kitchen table with Tom and his laptop.
My name's Tom, and I'm here today to learn how to save money on my prescriptions with Capital Blue Cross.
Capital's VP of Pharmacy Services, Meenock, is here. She's showing Tom how to use the Capital website to learn his prescription price before he heads to the pharmacy today.
You would want to know what is the cost of that medication to basically stretch your healthcare dollar, because that's your dollar.
The point is, members have options to save time and money. And if Tom wants to log on at 1 a.m. to renew a prescription, that's fine, too.
Having that flexibility to be able to order prescriptions at any time of the day or night is fantastic. And the mail order feature is really like a self-service feature. We love that.
Meenock doesn't usually make house calls, but today she's happy to help.
This is one of the ways we care more, so we do more.
Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone, by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make happen.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
I'm an innocent bystander.
You know, it's interesting. You know, I had someone ask me my number one reason why they should vote for Obama next November. And, you know, they were waiting for me to stumble and stammer, and I said Anthony Kennedy. And amazingly, it gave me this kind of bizarre, you know, the dog, you know, like the deer in the headlights kind of look like, who in the hell is Anthony Kennedy? And I said, well, probably the most powerful guy in the country that the majority of folks have never heard of. He is vote number 5 on the Supreme Court. He's in his late 70s. The next president will probably appoint at least one, possibly two Supreme Court justices. When you consider that Ruth Bader Ginsburg herself is in her late 70s. So you're looking at the two of these, you know, one on the so-called left and one on the right. With Kennedy, whoever the next president is, and the right knows this, the Wrecking Crew right understands that the next president is going to be able to appoint those justices. And that will swing the court either to a more progressive way, or it will keep it solidly extreme pro-business conservative. And I look at this stat of the week from the folks over at the Center for Responsive Politics, who says that five of the 9 justices on the Supreme Court hold personal fortunes worth at least $1 million. Current disclosure law only requires justices to reveal the value of their assets and liabilities within broad ranges. I mean, they're not going to tell you to the penny. But the 5 high court millionaires at the top end of these ranges, some sport somewhere in the $2.6 to $45.5 million estates. So, you know, pretty well off, pretty nice chunk of change in our Supreme Court justices' pockets. There's only one Supreme Court justice who came under the $400,000 mark, and that was Justice Sotomayor. And I would have guessed that. Personally, I would have guessed that. But here again, you know, the reason next November is so important is who sits on that Supreme Court. I mean, let's say, perchance, something pops up to change Citizens United, to disclose the amount of campaign money that corporations spend. Do you think a Supreme Court with 5 or 6 radical, rabid, right-wing Wrecking Crew members are going to vote in favor of making it constitutional to allow us to know who's spending money on our political system? Of course they're not. They gave us Citizens United. And that will be the litmus test for any Republican who they put in there. They don't care about abortion. They don't care about gay marriage. Those are fallback issues. Those are stuff we need to get people all lathered up and get their panties all in a twist. You know, that stuff is just to get people paying attention. The real important stuff, the money stuff, that's stuff that we never hear about, stuff that we never talk about because they never tell us. They just keep that divisive stuff. They keep us sliced and diced and neatly separated. So there you go. Those are, that's our Supreme Court justice, under $400,000. I'm not surprised. Not surprised at all. So what do you got for us tonight?
Well, as we talked off mic, Rick, there's a big election tonight in New York. Anthony Weiner, who...
Tomorrow.
Oh, it's tomorrow? Okay.
Tuesday.
I thought it was tonight. I stand corrected. There's an open election, and by all counts, a Republican is leading the Democrat. And here's the irony. The Democrat is Jewish. He's an Orthodox Jew. The Republican is not. Yet the Republicans have been successful in tying President Obama's position on Israel. And President Obama's position on Israel has been that he's called for negotiations with the Palestinians based on 1967 borders with Israel, and he believes that land swaps is the right way to go. And unfortunately, they have a large Jewish population in the district, and it's very unpopular. Now, the Democrat has said repeatedly, I oppose that. He has been to Israel 8 times. The last time he was with fellow lawmakers from New York, and he went in there to give support to the Jewish settlers who were being attacked by Hamas. And apparently, the polls are saying that the Republican has been in the lead so far. Also, and this I don't understand, there's an act called the James Zangora Act, which is providing health care to workers who are in Ground Zero. The Democrat supports it. The Republican does not. And with all that, the Republican is still in the lead. Now, if the Republicans win this, even though it might be a case where the Republicans just ran a good campaign, they had overwhelming numbers, they had overwhelming help, they had a huge amount of money, or if it was in the Israeli issue, I think what the Republicans are going to try to do, they're going to try to make it a national election and say that, well, this is a mandate, and they're going to try to say, well, this is proof that the American people want to change in 2012. And could it happen? I think the Republicans have a shot at winning this,
yeah,
which
polls,
is an upset.
The polls have them up by 6% right now. And what's interesting to me, and again, yeah, I don't think I ever gave Jerry Springer any credit for anything, but the guy, the Republican, is actually the guy who created the Jerry Springer show.
Jerry Springer was the mayor of Cincinnati at one time.
Yeah, the guy who bounced a check to a hooker.
Well, let me ask you something. Is that the first under the sun for a politician? I mean, come on.
Bounce a check to a hooker, yes. That is the first.
Well, no, wait a minute. Who's the guy that lost his job? The Attorney General in New York, who's extremely bright. He has his own show, and if you take the time to
listen. You
mean the
former governor?
Was he the governor?
Elliot Spitzer?
Was it Spitzer?
He
didn't bounce a check to a hooker. No, he used a credit card.
Again, yeah. He didn't bounce a check to a hooker.
No. My point is, just because he bounced a check to a hooker does not mean he's unintelligent.
I didn't say that. But here's the reality. Is that the Jerry Springer show, this guy created it. The Republican created it. He's the guy who's... Maybe we're going to turn Congress into the Jerry Springer show. That might get ratings. I may not be the only idiot when I go home watching C-SPAN.
Well, I do believe, this is just me, that he's intelligent enough to hold public office. But I believe after years and years of the Jerry Springer show, I'm not so sure that the public will vote for you if you've ever watched the show. But anyway, we're getting off the subject here. Interesting news coming out of L.A. Apparently, labor and business have come to this agreement that they're going to band together. And this project actually has the blessing of the environmental community. They're going to build, and I'm a little confused on this, Rick. They're going to build a NFL stadium in downtown L.A., and they're also going to refurbish the Los Angeles Convention Center. Total about 23,000 jobs, 11,000 permanent and 12,000 in the construction. And it's not going to be, they're not going to use $1 of taxpayer money. It's going to be built by a company called AEG. Again, I'm a little perplexed as to who's going to use that pro football stadium because LA doesn't have a football team. The Raiders do. Are the Raiders going to move back? They're not going to build a professional football stadium if nobody's going to use it. Now maybe it might turn into colleges using it. But anyway, in the end, that's 23,000 good paying jobs, not a dollar of taxpayer money being used. Good union jobs and you know, I tip my hat to these people. This is finally some good news. California can use all the jobs that they can get their hands on.
Maybe it's a scenario of if you build it, they will come. And maybe with Peyton Manning being injured, maybe the Colts will sneak out of Indianapolis like thieves in the night like they did in Baltimore.
I know what you mean. That was Ursay, I believe. Yeah. What can I tell you? But, you know, they have a pretty good... By the way, Peyton Manning, his career is, you know... They say it's a serious injury. But anyway, the piece de resistance tonight, we talked about Rick Perry and his using the term Ponzi scheme for Social Security. When you think about it, it's a real cheap shot. Ponzi scheme, you know, conjures up images of a system that's unfair, that's a house of cards that's really is not going to work for the investors. In fact, if you know anything about Ponzi, what he did was he paid the people who are already in the system by bringing in more and more people. And when he couldn't get enough people, it was a house of cards, literally. However, Social Security, you and I both know, we talked about this 100 times, can be fixed with just a few adjustments. Anyway, what the Center for Economic Policy did, they looked at the Congressional Budget Office, who said that it will be funded at 100% until the year 2038, and after that at 80% far into the future. Now, they looked at, they projected the Social Security benefits to the senators in Congress right now, and they picked out a man who I think is an up-and-coming star in the Republican Party, Marco Rubio from Florida. In fact, he's already been mentioned. The Republicans can't get the White House in 2012 as a potential presidential candidate. He's being groomed as a future star. And they looked at what his Social Security would be at the age of 67, and that would bring him to the year 2038. Believe it or not, he would receive in 1 year $41,439 and at least $33,151, both in 2011 dollars from then on. In short, these projections show that Social Security will continue to exist and pay a substantial benefit to retirees indefinitely. I thought it was a great report, by the way. If anybody wants to look at their U.S. senator, just go to the AFL-CIO site and look up the report on Social Security. It lists every senator if you're interested. I think what it does, it takes away, you come away from this report realizing that maybe these guys ought to take it out of their pocket if they really are worried about the Social Security system. I thought that was $41,000 for Social Security. That's a pretty good amount.
All righty. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back, wrap things up. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Together we will live on forevermore. Now we have defended from all things dark and cold. Now we are defenseless.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws and limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitative use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickschmithshow.com.
There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T. And DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today.
Yeah, sadly enough, it's kind of hard to argue with that. And their CEOs are paying themselves more than ever. In fact, David Olive wrote in the Toronto Star in the article, Should We Raise Taxes on the Rich, that business CEOs now pay themselves 325 times the compensation of shop floor and cubicle workers. The ratio was closer to 25 to 1 in the 1960s. And you wonder why we have a working class that is struggling. You wonder why we have a middle class that is dwindling. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Andy on line one. How are you doing tonight, Andy?
Fine, Rick. How about yourself?
I am fantastic.
Yeah, my computer happened to go out when I was listening to you. I didn't get to catch what was going on with that New York race. Is the Democrats actually losing?
No, the polling numbers have him down by have the Democrat down by about 6%, by 6 points. The election's tomorrow. It's on Tuesday tomorrow, so we'll cover some of that. But right now, the polling numbers have the Springer creator up by 6 points.
That's incredible. A Democrat should never lose in New York City. That's almost impossible.
It shows how. Maybe people just aren't paying attention. This special election's troublesome.
Hard to get people to come out to vote. The turnout's usually really, really low.
Yep.
Unless you could get people fired up somehow. And unfortunately, Obama is not doing that for our side.
Unfortunately not. The job speech, I was happy with the delivery of the speech. About time we see him get angry. But there was a lot of stuff in there I'm not thrilled with.
I don't like it all. That he's 55%, I think 246 billion of that is tax cuts to Social Security. It's cutting the Social Security payroll tax in half from what, the 12.4 to 6.2 total contributions?
No, it's cutting it down by 2%. They're cutting the 2% off of the employee side.
I think he wants to cut half of the entire bill.
Yeah,
That's where the 246 billion is coming from.
Yeah, I'll have to double check into that. I thought it was
12.4 down to a total of 6.2 from both the employer and the employee side. He wants to make it 3.1, 3.1 from both sides.
Well, I'm going to have to look into that. I thought it was just
check it out.
To maintain the 2% cut that he had had last time around. So I will double check.
He wants to maintain that and more.
I'm going to have to look at that.
Yeah, that's where that money's coming from. I don't like that at all. I didn't like it the first 2%.
I'm with you.
I thought that was wrong. But anyway. The reason I called was, I don't know, maybe you've commented on this, but it kind of bugs me. This AT&T T-Mobile merger, $39 billion worth, and you got the CWA hitting the airwaves and hitting the hearings that they're having on this pretty hard. Larry Cohen, and there was a guy here locally in California, Jim Whitecamp from District 9.
Yep.
That they're backing AT&T in this merger.
Yeah, well, AT&T
is going to be good for workers and good for jobs. I mean, what are these guys smoking?
Well, I mean, to be honest, now look, at the end of this, in their interest, it's going to mean more members. They have had a very difficult time organizing T-Mobile. In fact, it's amazing. It's a German company, and even the Verde, the union over there, can't believe what they get away with here in the U.S.
Don't believe anything that happens.
Right,
here.
But what they want from the union standpoint, look, it's going to mean more members. It's going to mean that they're going to be able to force them to bring some jobs back on the short term. From their perspective, it means you're going to grow a little bit, and you're going to be able to have a larger share of the industry unionized. I understand their position perfectly, And if I were them and that were my interest, I would pursue it as well. But from my standpoint, as someone who looks at democracy being a little bit more important, I don't want to have the consolidation of that resource into smaller and smaller number of hands.
Well, you're merging the number two vendor and the number four vendor.
Right.
And by subscribers and revenue, it's going to get you about 78% and over 80% market share by two vendors. That's monopoly. I mean, that's the end of the industry. Forget any competition.
And that's my concern. Now, from the union standpoint, honestly, you know, to be honest, for them, it's a good deal. And
you know, I could not see how possibly that could be a good deal. Because anytime you have a merger, you have to cut workers. Otherwise, there's no use of having a merger.
No, evidently,
because to have a merger by definition is synergies.
Right, and that's my.
The way you get synergies is by cutting labor. You've got to get rid of the redundancies.
And that has been my argument. But they're saying, and AT&T is telling them, and I guess it will be contractual, that they won't cut any workers. And they've looked at some of the past. I forget who it was that AT&T gobbled up, but they actually did maintain the current number of workers in both businesses over time.
I've never heard of that in any merger. In the finance area.
No,
any merger,
and I agree with
that. Never happening.
But their numbers, and I think it was it Cellular One? I forget who it was they bought up. But over the period of time, the number of employees has stayed constant because obviously they've grown. So the hope is that as they merge these two companies, they will grow and maintain that employee base. But I'm with you. The synergy thing, something that I didn't buy.
You have two different computer systems alone, accounting systems. I mean, you have two different computer systems in both companies. You only want one. You're going to get rid of the guys that you don't need from the other computer system, and you're going to merge and integrate and get the synergies into one. That's the whole idea of doing a merger, to get the economies of scale, to get the synergies. If you don't get the synergies, there's no use of having a merger.
Yeah. Well, at the end of it, that's the hope, and that's the best I can do on both sides. I'm with you. I'm not in favor of it. You know, much to the consternation of some of my union supporters, it's just something that I'm not fond of. But I do understand.
Larry Cohen's blowing smoke up our rear ends.
I think he can negotiate for those 5,000 call center jobs back, and he should do that so that we can organize them as well.
5,000. They're probably going to lay off 30,000. But anyway.
Well, we will see. Again.
Right. Great show, Rick.
Thanks so much, Andy. Appreciate the call.
Right. Bye bye.
Anyway, one of those things. I perfectly understand it, but from a personal standpoint, just not overly thrilled about it. And I know some of my union listeners and friends. How can you be against? I think you can organize T-Mobile anyway. I think with the pressure that you're getting from the German unions and the leadership there, I think eventually you could probably bring those in. But that's an awful lot of work.
And AT&T promised to bring some jobs back.
Well, yeah, the 5,000 call center jobs, but I think you can bring those, you can negotiate those and pressure those back anyway. And they should be doing that regardless. That should be happening front line and center right now. That's what should be going on. Anyway, I want to thank everyone for being here tonight, especially our two guests, Allison Hirsch and Aaron Gill. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, thericksmithshow.com is where you can download our podcast. If you've got a smartphone, Stitcher, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway, imperial, mysterious, and amorous array. Democracy is coming.